this evening, we have now convened again this morning. I know that yesterday there was a very hectic day for all of you, having gone through the attack that we're coming to the Department of Home Affairs, and I will see Dion was like red yesterday. And it was more darker than me.
The U.S. Navy is operating there. In fact, followed this very ship, destroyed some of these little pirate vessels that were being
The committee organized a number of programs that were led by the portfolio committee, even a seminar that was held here in Parliament, which had over 700 asylum seekers, refugees, and illegal immigrants who participated in that program. It was quite very disturbing. Yesterday, when you hear in the news that there were attacks which led to the loss of life somewhere in Atteridgeville, Pretoria, and then you still hear about the attacks somewhere here in the Western Cape of Somalians and all of that. During lunchtime yesterday, myself and members of the committee were like meeting, trying to reflect on this issue. And the committee sort of agreed that they will have to look at the agent intervention from the committee side, meaning that the committee will have to make some arrangement as a matter of agent to go and visit those areas there and to meet with the affected people there. Not only the affected people, but again, it will be important to engage with the communities that live in those areas. Because this matter is quite a very serious issue that as a committee we will condemn it, and it's something that we will not want to see it happening. But obviously, during the course of the day today, we will be meeting with a part of the presentation will be the High Commissioner for Refugees, who will be with us, who's here with us today, and part of, I think, what we'll have to share his experiences currently of working with these issues of refugees and asylum seekers in the country. And really, again, it's unfortunate that the department, I'm not sure if we have managed to get the person responsible for refugee affairs today. It would be great if a person is here. Sorry? She'll be here afterwards, as they wish. That's one of the problems that, you know, when we started yesterday, we raised a concern about the participation of the department in these public hearings, especially on people who are dealing with the implementation of the law itself. But without waste of time, the committee, before we adjourn this meeting, will have to then agree, we'll have a discussion and then agree on the way forward around what action must we take as a committee. Especially on the problems that have just happened in Pretoria. On that note, members, this morning what we'll then do will be to allow the public hearing to proceed. We'll invite the Consortium for Refugee and Migrant in South Africa I think it's Ms. Shange. She will make a presentation. It's a organization which is based, I think, here in the Western Cape. And then she will then give us the full, what's called a introduction. And then we'll then proceed after that, what's called a presentation. We'll then receive the Johannesburg Methodist Church bishop. I'm not sure if he has arrived. He's on his way, so meaning that we may reorganize the program. And I said that the reason that we invited the Johannesburg Methodist Church bishop was because of the recent arrest at the church of where a number of asylum seekers and illegal immigrants were arrested, and wanted him to come and share the experience with the portfolio committee, and he wanted, in fact, to make a presentation. Then from there, we would then change the program, because we're supposed to get the legal resource. I'm informed because of time again that we'll allow before lunchtime the UNHCR to come in, and then immediately after them we'll then have the legal resource center, and then we'll end with the AIDS law project and the TAC. I think we are still in order in that regard. Therefore, can I then invite the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa? And for your information, we are migrants ourselves, because we shuttle every weekend down to Cape Town. So you're speaking on our behalf at the same time. On that note, thank you very much, ma'am. And you can start your presentation and introduction.
Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. And also, I would like to say morning to everyone. My name is Sipele Mpilo Shange Butane, the first name being mine, and the thing being my father's, and the second being my husband's. I'm still trying to get mine. Okay, we'd like to take this opportunity to make this presentation to the Portfolio Committee. Ours is a very short presentation because the fundamental and more concrete issues have been covered by the presentation that was done by Lawyers for Human Rights yesterday, which is one of our members, and also we have endorsed the presentation, the submission that's going to be made by the AIDS Law Project and the TAC. Okay. The Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, which is commonly known as COMSA, welcomes the opportunity to make the submission before the Portfolio Committee of Home Affairs. As the national network of refugee and migrant service providers in South Africa, COMSA has an interest in ensuring that the rights of both South Africans and foreign nationals in the country are protected. Specific changes to the Refugees Amendment Bill have been handled in the submission by COMSA member Lawyers for Human Rights, as I've already mentioned. This submission will deal with some of the challenges surrounding the implementation of policy. While the Refugees Act of 1998 provided good policy, many challenges were presented in the implementation of the legislation. It is important that the challenges around the implementation are considered also in the process of considering the amendments to this act. COMSA welcomes the turnaround strategy initiated by the Director General of the Department of Home Affairs and trusts that the current challenges, such as the access to the refugee reception offices, and we've put the emphasis on including location, because one of the things that we've realized is that some of the refugee offices where they are currently positioned is quite a challenge to asylum seekers and refugees who are currently unemployed, and it becomes a really big problem for them when they are trying to access these offices. And then the issue of security inside and outside the refugee reception offices, and delays in the process in adjudicating asylum applications. We hope that those are going to be addressed by this strategy. It is vital that during this transition period, strong partnerships are formed between the government and civil society to ensure that any concerns or shortcomings in the process are addressed constructively. This requires an improved level of communication between the Department of Home Affairs, other government departments, and civil society. We believe this is quite important, especially because currently, in terms of the relationship between Home Affairs and other service providers, especially NGOs, you find that it's sort of an accuser-defender sort of a relationship where we as NGOs are seen to be constantly criticizing the Department of Home Affairs and Home Affairs having all the time to always be defending themselves. So we are hoping now that with the new changes that are in line at Home Affairs, we will have a more cooperative working relationship. And then the submission goes further to say migration poses both opportunities and challenges for us. Current challenges include the spate of violent xenophobic attacks on foreign nationals taking place across the country, as well as the challenges posed by increased numbers of Zimbabwean nationals in South Africa. Like, as the Chair has already mentioned, in terms of the xenophobia attack, this is a major problem that we are currently faced with. And yesterday, after this meeting, when I was checking my mail, I actually got one of my mail from one of the employees of the UNHCR who are saying that seemingly there are letters that are circulating in Garankuwa, Mabopane and Soshanguve warning foreigners to leave the area or there will be further attacks in those areas again. That situation is similar to what happened also in Mpumalanga last year, whereby Somali traders received the letters prior to the attacks. And nothing was done prior to the attacks until they actually did take place. So I'm really, really, I'm sitting here, but I'm really concerned in terms of what's going to be happening in these areas. Because for now, the attention is actually at Richfield, but already they are threats in other areas. Okay, these issues require strong leadership by government to stamp out such xenophobic attacks and present a clear and feasible policy with regards to regularizing the stay of large numbers of Zimbabweans and other nationalities who are currently in the country without documents. Through partnerships between government and civil society on such issues, we can turn such challenges into opportunities that will aid South Africa and regional development and safeguard the rights of all within the country in line with the rights provided by the Constitution. Look forward to working with the Department of Home Affairs and other government departments to this end. Thank you. That's my presentation.
All right. No, thank you very much, ma'am, for the presentation. But maybe you can share with us the, because we did not go specifically to the amendment, but just share with us your workings. Well, what is it that you do, and especially now that you raise the issue of of xenophobia and critical to what you have raised is the experience on the access of refugee centers. But on a day-to-day basis, what is it that you do as a consortium? I'm looking at this particular challenge that we are dealing with of a xenophobia attacks to people who not South Africans. Yeah, just share with us that. But before that, let me take another hand from Jukman. Low. Yes.
Thank you, Chair, for the question. Thank you for the presentation. Maybe just one question. You indicated in your presentation very much on the focus on government and civil society organizations to ensure that we create a culture of tolerance. My question is just in terms of the practical situation. You don't mention the Chapter 9 institutions. It's a bit of a concern for me. Can you maybe spell out, in terms of the practical situation, do you get assistance from the Chapter 9 institutions? What is the communication channel? What is their role? Because they've got a specific duty and role to strengthen constitutional democracy. So my question is really, what is happening there?
Yes, hello.
Chairperson, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. It was very short and to the point and very useful. Chairperson, on the plane down from Durban last night, I happened to be speaking to the Minister of Education, who I'm very glad to say is not travelling on my airline. So we happened to talk about this bill, and she made the point, and I think she's quite correct, that we almost need a publicity campaign in the country to deal with xenophobia, that it's becoming a major problem. And I think the presenter has made that point very eloquently this morning. My concern is that we can talk about a publicity campaign, we can talk about the theory of what we need to do. Mr. Buchman is quite correct about Chapter 9 institutions, using them and all sorts of other avenues that we have available to us. But until we deal with realities on the ground, and that's what I really would like the presenter to comment on, the fact, for example, that we do have tens of thousands of people coming to South Africa across our borders because to them South Africa offers hope, it offers a chance to survive that they wouldn't have in their own country. I'm not just referring to Zimbabwe, Chairperson, there are other countries as well, but that is the immediate one that springs to mind. The fact, too, that there are so few opportunities for jobs in this country, or we're not delivering the services in areas, so there is a real pressure on those, and communities therefore feel threatened when new people come in, and that's why you get these kind of threats and attacks. And I just wondered if we perhaps are deluding ourselves or not being serious if we realize until we deal with those problems and how we address those, the continued problems of xenophobia are going to continue, no matter how eloquent or how good a publicity campaign might be from the state to say, you know, we're all Southern Africans, we're all brothers and sisters, we belong together. We need to address the problems in other countries. We need to address the fact that we don't have enough jobs. We need to address the fact there aren't enough services, etc. I could go on. I think you know what I'm talking about. Perhaps if the presenter could just comment. comment along those lines and say, what do we do from a South African perspective? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Before you can I give Kofi Moromo to speak to?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question with relate to why the presenter did not mention any recommendation from the Auditor General with regard to the same job they are doing, Chairperson.
What did the Auditor General say?
The Auditor General, Chairperson, is suggesting many issues with regard to proper service delivery, computers are not linked, duplication of same people, and he suggested many issues, Chairperson, which can make refugee centers more accessible and more effective, Chairperson.
Oh, so you wanted that? Okay, that's fine. Now, thanks. Can you respond, ma'am? So we don't dwell much, but yeah. Can you respond then?
Okay, thank you. The first question deals with the work that the consortium does. Okay, the consortium was formerly known as the National Consortium for Refugee Affairs, and is currently based in Johannesburg at the West University. We are not part of the university. We are an NGO, but the university is currently providing us with the space from which we can operate. The work of the consortium is more of a coordinating. We are playing more of a coordinating role. The way we operate is we are a membership-based organization. Some of our members include Lawyers for Human Rights, the UCT Law Clinic, the South African Red Cross, some of the community-based refugee organizations, like the Coordinating Body for Refugee Affairs, and other organizations. So one of the things also that we do is we promote information sharing within the sector. Because what we've realized is that there is a number of organizations that are currently working in the refugee migrant sector, but everyone seems to be doing their own thing in their own corner. There isn't much information sharing and coordination. So that is where we come in. We also produce a newsletter every second week, which actually gives developments in terms of what's happening in the sector and what's new and all those kinds of information, like all the information that's relevant, not only to the service providers, but also to the refugees and migrants themselves. Okay. And then when it comes to the xenophobia, NCRA, as COMSA was formerly known, used to have a campaign which was called Rollback Xenophobia. I think some people here in this room will know about that campaign. But because of lack of funding, the campaign was actually went down in terms of them going out and making an impact out there. But currently we are trying to revive that, even though we may not still call it a rollback xenophobia, but definitely work is being done around the xenophobia in the country. And then the second question was asking about the role of Chapter 9 institutions. Okay. Actually, last week we were just discussing this in the office with my colleagues, because currently there's just two of us. The one institution that we have been using is the South African Human Rights Commission. And even now, we've kept them informed in terms of all the incidences that have been happening, and they've given us advice in terms of how to take some of those matters up. So we are working with the Human Rights Commission on that. And also, there is a steering committee that we've just established to try and deal with the issues of xenophobia, not only when the incidences happen, but even prior to that. So the Human Rights Commission also is part of that. And the Department of Home Affairs Counter Xenophobia Unit is also part of that committee. So definitely we are using one of the Chapter 9 institutions, but then like I'm saying last week, we're just exploring in terms of the role of the other institutions, like the public protector, in trying to address some of these issues. And then the issue number three was related to, the challenge of addressing xenophobia while South Africans are also still experiencing problems of their own. That is a challenge that we have also identified in the organization, and that is a challenge that was actually identified from some time ago, and that is why currently we are on a drive to get as many South African organizations, not to say South African as in being based in South Africa, but organizations which are not exclusively refugee or migrant-focused organizations, but organizations that are dealing with other service issues in the country, so that while we are trying to make the situation better for refugees, but we're trying to make it better for everyone. If I may just also quote an incident that happened last year when we were in Delmas, trying also to address some of the attacks that had taken place there. When I spoke to the group, they're both refugees and migrants, the South Africans were actually very angry towards me, specifically myself, because they were saying, Mpilo, we have had so many problems with our own government, and never, never even once have we seen you in this area being on our side. And all of a sudden, now that these non-nationals, the foreigners have been affected, you drive all the way from Johannesburg to Mpumalanga to try and help them. So yes, we do take cognizance of the fact that there are issues that South Africans are currently grappling with. And it is true that in some instances, it is true that so long as those are not addressed, xenophobia may not be kept. But that does not at the same time stop us from going out and doing those publicity campaigns to make people aware as to why foreigners find themselves in this country. Like, same again in Mpumalanga, when I was doing a presentation, the people were saying, okay, it's fine, we understand the situation of refugees. We will no longer attack the refugees, but we attack the migrants. Because the migrants are here for jobs, and we do not have the jobs. It's fine, refugees are fine, we cannot force them to go back home. So there is a need, yes, I agree, to actually try to address both. Because when you engage with those people, with the South Africans, you find that they have a lot of complaints that they have in terms of service delivery that's not taking place. And when you ask them, have you tried this avenue, have you tried this avenue, people are saying, but no one has ever told us that we can do that. So the onus is upon all of us, those servicing the refugees and the migrants, and also those that whose mandates are actually specific along the South African population, to do something in terms of improving service delivery in the country. And then the third one was, why no mention of the Auditor General's recommendations in terms of some of the improvements that are going to be done within Home Affairs? Okay, just to be honest, I haven't really gone through the Director General's reports. What I just saw was on the news last week, I think it was Friday, where you were saying South African borders are too porous. So it's one of the things that I just need to go through. But then if it's related to improving service delivery, access to the refugee reception offices, that is definitely something that we will support if it's going towards a positive direction. Thank you.
Okay. Now then, as a consortium, your main partner will be UNHCR, obviously. And I just want to hear what's the relationship there again. We're trying to see how, because I know that there are so many organizations that deals with issues of migrants, I mean illegal immigrants and even illegal immigrants and the asylum seekers and refugees. So yourself being the center, obviously, so you sort of relate to each one of them. Specifically on this one, what is your relationship?
Okay, thank you, COMSA and UNHCR have a very good working relationship. Actually, UNHCR used to be one of our funders before. They were funding some of our programs, and especially the Rollback Xenophobia campaign. And even now, we still have a very good working relationship. And this email that I was actually talking about also was from one of the staff from the United Nations, because we do have that relationship, and we do share information in terms of what is happening. And they were also part of that committee that I spoke about, that we are trying to develop a strategy to address issues of xenophobia and like issues, all the other issues related to access to the asylum process. Thank you. So there is a working relationship.
Okay. So thank you very much, ma'am. Mama Tibela, so that we close it. Yeah? That will be the last speaker.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I had a presenter talking about a lot of other organizations, NGOs. I just wanted to know, why don't you work together? Come together and do something. Why is it that each and everyone does his or her own? Why can't you come together? Thank you.
Okay, the reason why, if I understand you correctly, is the reason for the existence of the consortium really is to bring people together. But having one organization at this point, I don't think it's really going to be feasible, because within the refugee migrant sector, there are a lot of issues that need individual specific attention. So the consortium is there to bring everyone together for us to deliberate on the issues affecting refugees and migrants. But we still need those specialist skills that each individual organization brings to the network.
All right. No. So thank you very much. You have raised the obvious. The issue that you raised was the partnership with Home Affairs and the issue of the refugee centres. I think the bill, the amendment, speaks to that directly, to say that the Director General will have more powers now to open as many refugee centres in the country. With regard to partnerships, obvious, between yourself and Home Affairs, you need to develop some kind of a relationship there. With the committee, I think we are fine. Now that you have met us and we have known you now, I think we'll have a wonderful relationship in, you know, really dealing with issues that you are confronted with on a day-to-day basis. The issue that you did not dwell much on, it was the migrant issue, and you sort of touched it, but it does not come out very clearly. I said in front of you the migrants who are sitting here, and you did not want to deal with that, but it's okay. You may not respond on it, but thank you very much, ma'am. We're looking forward to engage with you, especially with these challenges that that we are currently faced with. But the biggest thing, obviously, which Mama Chivele has raised, is this coordination of the of organizations that deal with issues of refugees and asylum seekers. There are so many of them, and some of them are funded, you know, separately, and they do their own programs, and but sometimes it's critical that they will have to look at, you know, galvanizing, in fact, they all of them into a particular one program that will be sort of led either by yourself or the UNHCR program, that, you know, each and every of these consortium organizations will then focus on that particular program, especially when you look at issues of xenophobia and all of that. I think we'll look at that in the time to come. On that note then, members, as I have said to members, that we'll have an opportunity ourselves as a committee to reflect seriously on this issue, and then we'll then have to develop a particular approach that we must come up with later in the afternoon today, to see how best we can sort of intervene with this big crisis that is facing us. Now, the second presenter will be Johannesburg Methodist Church, and I think that the bishop is here. You need just occupy one of the chairs outside, the bishop. Welcome, Bishop. You'll then introduce yourself, and we're happy to have you in this meeting here. I know that we've been trying to meet for some time, but due to, you know, a schedule of our work, this side has been very difficult, but I'm happy that you are here today. You can then share with us and maybe reflect again on the amendments that are before the committee, but you can share with us your experiences and the current issues that you are dealing with from that point of view. So thank you very much, and you are welcome. You can have a platform.
Thank you very much. I'm Paul Varane. I'm the Bishop of the Central District of the Methodist Church of Southern Africa. I suppose the very first point I would like to make is that the most frustrating thing is that we have an outstanding constitution, and certainly when I read through the bill there are some good improvements, but there is a disconnection between the intention and the delivery, and it does seem as if there's very little conversation going on between the departments of Home Affairs, departments of Justice, departments of Safety and Security, and so on. And one of the for me, one of the most critical things is that there needs to be a kind of cooperation between these departments. It actually doesn't matter whether you have the most magnificently magnanimous refugee bill if your police are victimizing on a daily basis people all over the country. If not victimizing them, abusing them and hounding them. So for me, that is a critical problem. Our experience in the inner city of Johannesburg is the fact that although the police are now very ginger to come into the church premises, as you can imagine, on the streets of Johannesburg, there is a vigorous campaign to arrest foreign nationals. And there is a range of experiences that these foreign nationals would have. We try our best to get people to the Department of Home Affairs as soon as we possibly can, as soon as they get into the building. And we would have between, let's say, 10 and 30 new people coming to the building every day. And we would want to get them to the Department of Home Affairs. They go to the Department of Home Affairs, and at the present moment, appointments are about 2 months away, with no evidence that you've been to the Department of Home Affairs. So then you wander around the streets of Johannesburg. You're confronted by the police. The police then take you to John Forster Square, and I deliberately called it that. And you then end up being charged and taken to prison for a term, and then off to Lindela, and then back to the border and across the border to a birthday party, and then back to South Africa. But by then you've got a criminal record. So that is of deep concern to me. What is particularly of concern is that some of the people who have been subject to this treatment are particularly vulnerable. Some of them have medical documentation of evidence of torture, and so they escape from, let's say, Zimbabwe, very vulnerable, come to this country, do what they have to do, and then are arrested and go through a second trauma and then are deported. So for me, there has to be consultation and conversation between the Department of Safety and Security, for starters, and the Department of Home Affairs. I'm sure you're also aware of the news coverage on the court appearances of those who were arrested at the church, and probably the most disgraceful of those court appearances were the court appearances in Court 2 of the magistrate set up in Johannesburg, and indeed that magistrate will be taken on review, I believe. But it was, to say the least, a shoddy and dismissive and cynical treatment of human beings, very reminiscent of 1970s and 1980s. Then, to say further, the second concern that I have is that refugees or asylum seekers or exiles are in a sense being systematically criminalized. I think this is part of the problem with the press, but it is also certainly the attitude of the police services, is that the nexus of crime in South Africa lies in the refugees. They are the ones who are causing this gigantic problem in South Africa. And so they are treated as criminals. And my experience of the police's confrontation with refugees is exactly that. there is a very, very discourteous approach to refugees, as if they are definitely criminals. In fact, last week we had an incident in which we have a shop in that belongs to the church and is rented, and there was an altercation between the cashier and one of the customers. The customer then went to the police. The police then came into the shop, and well, the eventual result of that was that they arrested four people, one Ethiopian and three Mozambicans. I contacted the DG for Home Affairs, who then inquired and was told that the people that had been arrested were high on the list of criminals and had been looked for. But they released them. This is Wednesday afternoon. On Thursday afternoon, the criminals were released back into the city. And but it just demonstrates the fact that the assumption is that refugees are criminals. In terms of the documentation, in terms of the amendment, there are two things I would want to note. First of all, my sense from the amendment is that the position of the judiciary is diminished, and the powers of the department, and particularly in the person of the DG, are quite substantially increased. And I'm not 100% certain whether that distance with the judiciary in terms of evaluation of refugee status is a wise one. I also sense that there may be value in putting fairly rigorous and consistent vigilance on the workings of Home Affairs. Unfortunately, our experience from cleaners to security to right through the department is that there is a reasonable amount of corruption and bribery going on in the department. We have an ecumenical refugee ministry, and they have been monitoring Marabastat for several months now. We had a good meeting with the Director General, in which a fairly carefully documented presentation was given to him, and suggestions made, in actual fact, that fairly serious attempts need to be made at eradicating the corruption that is in the Department of Home Affairs. And it all goes around bribes and access and intimidation and so on. And certainly the people that come back to the church, having had an experience of Home Affairs, speak of a very unpleasant experience. I also do believe that that we need to understand which conventions we're following in terms of the, is it the African Union conventions, or is it the United Nations conventions relating to refugees. My understanding is that the African conventions are much wider, and so the rigorous distinction that is made between economic and political is not as rigorous as it is in the United Nations distinctions. I could be wrong. But let me just say that as far as Zimbabwe in particular is concerned, to make the distinction between economic and political refugees is sometimes an inaccuracy, because it is a known fact that in Zimbabwe, if there is a perception that one is in opposition to the government, one is prejudiced against in terms of food distribution, in terms of assistance, in terms of all sorts of things. For instance, the teaching profession in particular in Zimbabwe seems to have come under fairly consistent and and rigorous attack. I think it would be true to say that at any time we have between 400 and 500 school teachers living in the building at Central Methodist. And the perception, apparently, from ZANU-PF and the government is that the teachers are undermining of the government and anti-establishment and therefore are a danger. And so many of them have been threatened and have been told by friends that they are on hit lists and need to get out of the country. But when they come to this country, obviously the reason they come is so that they can procure employment to support their families. And apparently when they go to Home Affairs, immediately they indicate that they are economic. The possibility of them getting ultimately refugee status is slim. And perhaps just finally, also just one last, one other thing is to say that I believe that recently people who have been arrested are being taken to make application for asylum at some offices, and they are taken handcuffed by the police. Now, I was told this morning by Dr. Emmanuel Ngenzi and asked to mention it here, because clearly that is a violation of both our constitution and of the Refugee Act as far as we can read it. We have had, as you could hear, a conversation with the Director General of Home Affairs. He has agreed that he would like to convene a meeting between the ministries and the DGs or their equivalents in the Departments of Safety and Security and Home Affairs, so that there is coordination and an end to the victimization, and also the possibility of engaging interpreters who will hopefully not be corrupt. I think that's as much as I want to say.
Okay.
Unless you want me to...
No, thank you very much. But can you sort of share with the committee what is it that the church is offering to either refugees or asylum seekers or illegal immigrants who are currently at your church? I know that the police arrested, I'm told, over 500 people that were arrested in the church. And just share with us, what is it that the church is doing, and why is the church keeping your so-called asylum seekers or refugees in the church, and how are you sort of as a church able to deal with the day-to-day life of those people, providing them with food and all of that? But much is, I hear you saying that when these people go to Home Affairs, they'll go there, they'll never get any assistance, and they come back to the church. And I think it's quite for some time that has been happening. Clearly is that there's no service. And which office specifically that you can relate to say that we take these people, we go with them to a particular office for them to apply for whatever document that they want to apply for, and there's no assistance. And at no point that, in fact, you have met. I know that Home Affairs is demarcated into provinces. That's why the committee wanted to meet with provincial managers, because those are people that you deal with directly, other than the director general, who may not be very much conversant with the issues as you deal with them. But it's very important for the committee to understand that particular experience and use a kind of engagement between yourself and refugees and asylum seekers who are sort of living within the church premises. I think it's important. Then from there, what we can then do? Let's hear that first, and then I'll give you an opportunity to come back after. Yes.
Well, people come to the church because the other alternative, by and large, the streets of Johannesburg, which are violent and crime-ridden, and they would come to the church for shelter. We have had ambivalent success with soup kitchens in the church, but many of the people in the building would be involved in making food and selling food at a very reasonable price to others. A large number of the people in the building go out during the day. In actual fact, I would say 95% of the people in the building go out during the day to try and find some kind of piece work to sustain themselves and obviously to send money back home. The church also has MSF, have established a clinic in the church, and so they see between 70 and 80 people a day. We also have a home-based care facility in the building which takes care of particularly vulnerable AIDS sufferers, but also people who perhaps have been released from hospitals still weak. We have a sort of creche upstairs which takes care of the babies in the building so that their mothers can go out and look for work. We have a preschool in the basement of the building. We also have an ABED training center in the building which helps people who haven't advanced in their education. We have an English, maths and science clinic which is quite specifically aimed at South African learners. We have French and English lessons being taught in the building, and then a whole lot of other things that the refugees themselves have put together, like reading clubs, chess clubs, karate clubs, soccer teams, volleyball teams, and so on. So in a sense, the people in the building have created their own community. We also offer the diploma in theology of the joint board, and we've got several learners involved in that. We also have, from time to time, Latin American and ballroom dancing that happens in the foyers of the church. So, yeah, it gives you an idea of why people come to the church. The experience of home affairs is not that there's absolutely no help. It's just that when you go to home affairs, it's this delay. The delay of, I mean, people are getting appointments now for the end of May, and it is that 2 month period of vulnerability where if they happen to, they don't get anything from home affairs. They don't get, home affairs have, the most I've heard is that home affairs have said to them, if the police pick you up, give them this number to phone. And the police are not interested in doing that. Sometimes I have heard complaints that the police have in actual fact torn up asylum papers in front of the people and told them that you forged these papers, these are not real papers, and so on. So it's not that there's absolutely nothing going on at Home Affairs offices, it's just very, very slow. And in some places, intimidating and unfriendly.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Can I give now members? We'll take through the line.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question to the presenter, Chairperson. While I understand the presenter is running his own government inside the church, Chairperson, I just want to find out from the presenter whether he understands the laws of this country. We've got immigration laws, immigration regulations. How do you advise the same people who are coming to jail, your own church, and dance and make their own laws? And I'm also having a concern, Chairperson, with regard to interpretation of a refugee by the presenter. According to him, if you oppose a Zimbabwe government, you automatically qualify as a refugee. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, Mama Chivela, we'll take the line.
Okay.
We'll give you an opportunity to respond and then we'll put up engagement.
Thank you. Might I respond immediately?
No. Just note them.
Okay.
Note them. We'll take, I think, 3 or 4, and then from there we'll give them up.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Bishop was talking about a lot of Zimbabweans who are in South Africa who have been punished there, from who's got scars and so on. What I just wanted to ask the Bishop was that, did the Bishop ever try to encourage, as they are going to the polls this weekend, for them to go back and vote?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to vote a government out. You cannot just do. They might be able to vote this government out and get a new government in. Thank you.
Encourage the Bishop to encourage them to join politics. Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yukman? Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation, Bishop. My question is, if we live in an ideal world, what would be your suggestion? I mean, in effect, you act as a kind of, reception center. But if we want to improve this reception center concept, what would your advice be for the parliamentary committee to look at? And then if we look at the act, I mean, of course, the advice will be that we must put in the regulations time frame. But what is your feeling about maybe putting those time frames in the act more strictly to ensure that, in terms of transparency, that the time frames are much more user friendly? That will, of course, put a lot of pressure on resources and so on of the department and so on. But my question is, what practical steps would you propose to improve the practical situation?
Let me give Cakes will be the last one so that the Bishop can then respond, and then we'll start. Now we'll go to the parliament. We have agreed that you'll be the last speaker. We'll do it. Yes.
Bishop,
so are you not satisfied that you'll be the last speaker? No, I'm saying that he can respond, then we'll take the next round. And then that next round will start from low, and then you'll be the last speaker. Okay? Okay, thanks.
Bishop, you have my sympathy. I personally disagree with the idea of abusing people in whatever manner when they are in one's country. I always argue that if you don't need them, send them back home, but don't abuse them. But my question is in line with what the last speaker was saying. In your view, what would you expect the police to do when they meet illegal people with no documentation, nothing? How do you expect them to react when they're supposed to deal with that type of people in a country? I hear that you're saying they do go to Home Affairs, and because of the schedule, they are 2 months behind appointments, and therefore they are in the street without documents. But just help us. How would you deal with that situation? Because where does the police draw the line that this one has been to Home Affairs, this one is illegal, this one is a refugee? How do you help us? How do you expect the police to deal with that situation?
Thank you. Can the phone now, Bishop, can I give you an opportunity to respond?
Yes, my response to the first speaker is I'm not as naive as he may think concerning the law. And I don't run a gangster parade in the church at all. And I'm not as naive as thinking that everybody who disagrees with the government must be given automatic refugee status. I mean, you have set in place systems of evaluation But I'm saying that sometimes those systems are not adequate in understanding the nuances that some people have to face back in their countries. I am concerned that I almost detect in the question exactly what one has to face over and over again, and that is that basically exile the criminals. Then the second thing concerning the vote, we have encouraged people to follow the procedures that are there. It costs money, however, to get back to Zimbabwe. And I mean, if the person who asked the question could give us a source of money to get people back into Zimbabwe so that they can vote, that would be very helpful. However, for some people, it is particularly dangerous to go back. And there's absolutely no doubt. Somebody who has medical evidence of being tortured clearly is going to be pursued. And I would advise them not to go back. But I can tell you that there are many, many people who are wanting to go back, despite the fact that certainly news reports indicate that the likelihood of the rigging of the vote seems to be very much in place at the moment. With regard to reception centres and what would be the ideal, I should imagine, I can understand the huge amount of work that there is in the Department of Home Affairs and the backlog, but I was wondering whether there would not be some kind of initial document of protection that could be given to somebody as soon as they arrived at the Department of Home Affairs. I also happen to think that the whole way in which it's done can be speeded up and can be much more friendly. I've been to the reception centres, and they don't come across as a sort of warm, free, open place that South Africa is meant to be. And I'm wondering whether there just couldn't be an entire revolution of our entire attitude. In the end, we can make a decision. These people are going to stay. These people are going to go. And I agree completely with you that we don't have to abuse them. All we just have to say is no. You need to return to your country. We can't give you asylum. Asylum is protection. You don't really need protection. But I think that the way we do it is what really is very different. I mean, I've actually thought, we speak about xenophobia, I wonder whether some form of legislation or some kind of censure should be put in place legally to begin to start dealing with the issue of xenophobia. Because certainly we found ways of dealing with racism fairly rigorously. And I should imagine that in exactly the same way as we deal with racism, we should deal with xenophobia. I think that you've raised exactly the issue. When a policeman comes across a person who has absolutely no documentation, they don't have a choice, because the person is illegally here. But the problem is that the person might have done everything in their power to become legal and have not been able to do it because of the awkward bureaucracy. And so that's why that, you know, either a document which indicates that the person is in the process and needs protection, but certainly not the vulnerability that some people have to face at the moment.
Bishop, thank you very much indeed for your input. Can I ask you a couple of very quick questions, please? You mentioned the problem specifically of teachers from Zimbabwe. I think the word you used was slim, very slim chances of finding employment. Now, to my knowledge, the Department of Home Affairs has a website where they list a whole lot of strategically needed positions, skills with a short. I think there's 1,500 science and math teachers. Now, it may be that Zimbabweans don't teach math and science, but I understand that there's a huge calling for math and science teachers. In your experience, is that a problem? Is it because, perhaps you could just tell me why you found that there's very slim chances of finding employment, particularly for Zimbabweans who are skilled in maths and science. Could I just ask you also just to expand a little bit about the question of the judiciary? You made the point that you felt that the judiciary didn't have the kind of, maybe I'm quoting you incorrectly, but the overall control of the act or the amendment to the act that they should have. In fact, it was more in the hands of the department or the officials, whatever. Perhaps you could expand on that. And just in your experience, the question of crime, it often comes to, certainly within the media, and it's sort of almost urban legend, that foreigners in this country are the ones mainly responsible for crime. In your experience of managing the number of people that you do in your area, what is your experience, if any, of crime? Are many people involved in crime, or are they, as you say, just out looking for peace work? If you could perhaps just give us a little info on that. And then finally, in your... to your point, I don't know how many people you've got in this building, but it seems like there are a large number. You talk about 400 or 500 teachers, at least. If there were to be regime change in Zimbabwe, and I share your cynicism about the not drinking of a poll, but should there be a regime change, what, in your experience, would be the effect of the number of refugees in Johannesburg, for example? Would people then return home to their homeland? Because from my experiences at Home Affairs border places, people only come here because they're forced to. They actually don't want to leave Zimbabwe, that they have no other option. And I just wondered if we found a regime change there, would people actually return to their own world? What I'm trying to say, would your problems be dissipated? We wouldn't then deal with the immediate problem on our border. And then the other question that has been raised, but perhaps you could just be more specific about it. You've made some very good arguments about what you think is wrong and where we're going wrong with the legislation. Can you give us some input as to what we need to do to change it? What needs to be in this legislation as far as things are now, but more importantly as far as the amendments are concerned? What specifically should we be doing or writing into the law? And you're talking to an accountant, not to a lawyer, so be as specific as you need to be. What needs to change to make those things work better so we can actually get the outcomes that you would like to see? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank Bishop for the presentation. Also, I'd like to thank you for the good job that you have done in the past and still continue to do today. I'm one of those people that we have assisted in the past during the dark days of apartheid. We used to come to you together with the lady from Nohali, trying to assist displaced people from Mute. And we really appreciate that. Now, Comrade Chair, my question is, there have been some serious allegations, Bishop, from the security forces, and we have alluded to it also in our presentation, that the church is housing ardent criminals. And what I want to know is that are there some measures in place to make sure that you scrutinize these people who are coming to the church, to make sure that you will really assist real asylum seekers and refugees, not these ardent criminals? Second, this is the question of vote in Zimbabwe. I think it is wrong to preempt the election results by saying there is rigging and whatever, whilst the elections have not yet taken place. I think we have some observer missions internally there and from the Africa and other parts of the world. So I think it is wise to wait for those observer missions to come and say, this is what we have observed in Zimbabwe, to proclaim elections to have been fair or unfair. And I think also, Bishop, it's a little bit rude to say a person who was asking a question about the vote, I mean, the people to go and vote should provide the funding. I think you are just asking me for the mere fact that maybe because there are some international funders to you, maybe is there any possibility of assisting these people? Not that it is your responsibility. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right. All right, yes, Bishop?
Respond.
Yes, respond.
Let me apologize to the mother that asked that question. You must understand the whole question of funding is so vexed, and money is a huge issue. With regard to teachers, what has happened is that we have been assisted in getting onto the website into departments of education throughout the country. The lists of teachers and their qualifications that we have. SACWA has been particularly helpful in getting their qualifications evaluated, and we've also now got the SACE, what do they call it, qualification, South African Council for Educators, the professional qualification recognized, which is what one needs in this country to be able to be employed. And we are beginning to see that particularly maths and science teachers are being employed, particularly in Natal. Some in Gauteng, particularly in Natal. But I think we are dealing with a situation in the country where employment opportunities are few and far between. And so, you know, we have a large number of teachers who are doing all sorts of things like cleaning, selling newspapers, that kind of stuff. Let me deal with the crime issue. And also to say that just as we've been in conversation with the DG for Home Affairs, we've also been in conversation with commissioners of police in the area. We are just about on the verge of signing a partnership with the police, because in principle there was absolutely no problem with the raid. I don't have difficulty with the police coming into the building and checking to see whether there are criminals, and I'm also aware of the fact that we're vulnerable as far as that is concerned. You know, the building is a complicated building, and so it is easy for mischief makers to do their business outside and to come in. And we have certainly been able to identify their location and where they work in the building, and yeah, we have fairly rigorous security in the building. Where people are searched for weapons when they come into the building, and there are rules in the building which try to facilitate the best kind of community cooperation that we possibly can have. And let me say to you that if somebody is out of order in the building, there's absolutely no question about us calling the police to come in to help us. And let me also say that some of the experience with the police has been quite outstanding. The police have come in and resolved conflicts in the building and have helped us to be able to get through some very sticky patches. You can imagine, there are about 1,300 people in the building. You're not going to have that number of people without incident happening from time to time. And I mean, I have spoken about the cooperation that we've had from the police on more than one occasion. And they have helped us. And what we're looking at the moment is the possibility of the police being able to come into the building with very specific mandates to help us with the whole question of crime. What would make Home Affairs operate in a better way? I should imagine that a fairly rigorous limitation on time, you know, so the
person comes to this country, they must have reported to Home Affairs within a week, and within that week, they must have some kind of evidence that they have been there, communication with police services, that until a proper evaluation has taken place, they should not be harassed. I also think that setting up an inspectorate that can go from Home Affairs office to Home Affairs office, an independent inspectorate that could evaluate the work, and that is happening all the time, and that there is no warning that that inspectorate will be doing their work. I should imagine that that might be something that might be able to help in some direction. To answer your question about scrutinizing criminals, we can't scrutinize criminals. We don't have a system of being able to detect whether we have people in the building, you know, who if we took their fingerprints, we would, you know, it would come up as a red alert. So we work very strictly on a open door policy, and we don't discriminate. But it doesn't take too long before people who misbehave can be detected, and then we would expel them from the building. They would need to find another place to stay. The rules of the building are the following. The first rule is that you need to be involved in education in some way. No smoking, particularly of dacha, in and around the building. No drinking of alcohol in or out of the building. No fighting, no stealing. Unmarried, no sex in the building. Keep the place clean. And they have to be in church every night at 7 p.m. Those are the rules of the building.
Okay. So every night you have 1,200 people at service.
Yeah, it's a good evangelical instrument, let me say. You can imagine. I suppose that of the 1,200, about 300 of them would be sound asleep because they would have got moving early in the morning. But yeah, they come. The church service is really a place in which we try and pass around community news. So, for instance, farmers in the Eastern Cape would contact us and say, we need pickers. Can you send 30 pickers down, pickers of citrus fruit? So we would do that. Or there is a job offer in Mpumalanga, or there is... So that kind of thing happens, and that kind of announcement then would happen in the church service. If there are problems that we have got to face in the building, discipline problems, or if there's a difficulty with water or with electricity or whatever it may be, that is the space in which we would talk about those issues.
Okay. Now, thank you very much, Bishop. I just have a few recommendations and questions. You just started with one of the things that you just said, the issue of farmers in the Eastern Cape, either Mpumalanga. If you have watched the third degree, was the third degree last night, or the day before yesterday, the special assignment on this a cheap labor and the harassment of farm workers. Now, the question I'll ask you is that, How is this thing regulated, the manner in which you coordinate with this, and what government policy are you following to deal with this thing of transport, or, you know, providing a what you call a person power to help the farmers? And before you respond, the issue of Home Affairs comes in. You have been having a number of meetings with the Director General of Home Affairs, but I don't hear you saying, this is what we have agreed upon, especially looking at your center. I'll treat it like a center now, more of a church. That you have this center that you have 1,200 refugees, asylum seekers, or illegal immigrants. Obviously, the issue of illegal immigrants comes in because they your Section 49 of the Immigration Act, harboring illegal immigrants is an offense itself. So meaning that there will be a problem there for you. Now, what I wanted to understand was that now that because you have this community, which is very active, obviously, by looking of things, what is the Home Affairs arrangement between you and them? Because if you have that established community already, 1,200 people who come and live, I would believe that Home Affairs will be more of your friends than anybody else. Because if you look all over the country, there's not a center that can accommodate so many people as they go. And I think that would be a priority for Home Affairs to say, this is our target area, therefore we want to help those that are there in the hands of the bishop, obviously, to give them necessary documentation. Your social welfare department, the general, even the condition in which they live. I don't hear you saying that the Department of Labor has been here, or social development has been here, that children there, either they go to school or they don't go to school, and all of those issues. And this current, you know, training that is taking place inside, well, what is the relationship between you and the Department of Education? Because, you see, we do not want to create a center that now begins to do what you have just said now, that we now work with farmers, that we provide them with labor, and then these people go there, whatever that happened, they come back. Or because there's this belief, not even only a belief, every year when it's harvesting time, a lot of farmers at the borderline will recruit many people who come for harvesting period. When they're supposed to pay them month end, they'll call the police to come and arrest them. And then police will come, probably so, arrest them, take them to Lindela. The following day, they're deported back to the country of origin. And the bishop will keep on providing. I don't hear you saying that these people that we send, this is a minimum salary that they pay them. We coordinate them, we monitor them, and they come back after whatever service that they've provided. Or the farmers provide transport to come and fetch them. Who's sending them? As much as the point that the honorable member raised earlier, especially with Zimbabweans, that Zimbabweans, you know, here's an opportunity again that is presenting itself for them to go and vote. And the issue is that who's paying for this transportation of people from Johannesburg to Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal and coming back and all of that? During December time, I think the church is empty with Zimbabweans. Because December time, they present themselves either at Home Affairs or the police station, they get arrested, they're deported back. It's a means of transport, free transport that they get back to Zimbabwe during holidays. And then they come back after holidays. There are syndicates that operate. Based on the experience that we have, you know, I think it's a well-organized movement there, a transportation movement. Now, these are things that we want to hear because it's an experience that is new, and then we are dealing with this issue. The issue that you raised, the inspectorate with Home Affairs, is the role of the portfolio committee. I don't see this portfolio committee sort of taking away its responsibility. There is a responsibility to do oversight and to inspect, you know, the condition. That's why you know about Marabastat, which we give the Department of Home Affairs 14 days to correct that situation. Or else to close down the office, the center, because the condition was very bad there. So these are things that, you know, in whatever that we do, Bishop, we must make sure that we do it within the premise of the law, because there's a law that, you know, govern all of these issues that you're dealing with, which much we appreciate, that you sort of alleviate the problem that the country will be faced with, or we are faced with. The role of, you know, I'm so happy today we have the UNHCR. We have all earlier said that we don't have refugee camps in our country and will not have refugee camps in this country based on the experience that all of us know. Therefore, what is the role that they, you know, you get this and who's helping you? I mean, the soup and the bread and the what, I mean, it's another thing. But who's helping this church to be able to accommodate a 1,200 people, maybe who will come and live and all of that? So it's very important for us to understand that. But the issue of harboring of illegal immigrant, Bishop, it's a very dangerous thing because it goes with an offense and you can be charged there. You see, so I'm saying that how then do you try and avoid that situation when Home Affairs is not responding? to the watchful, to the needs, in fact, of the people who are at the center.
Okay. All right, let me just deal with the labor thing. The Department of Labor and the CCMA have spent some time in the building with the refugees. They've come in and spent actually hours explaining the rights that people have with regard to labor. The Legal Resources Center have placed an intern in the building, and so we have fairly rigorous watchfulness around the human rights regarding labor abuse. I suppose it happens in three ways. The first is that a person will say to somebody, I'll employ you and I'll employ you for 80 rand a week. And a lot of these negotiations are taking place, don't involve the church at all. People go by themselves and do it. And then when it comes to the end of the week, the person pays them 20 rand. And they don't seem to have recourse to any help as far as that is concerned. So they then would go to the legal resources person, who will then take out a case at CCMA. So we are in partnership with the CCMA and the Department of Labor. In actual fact, the Department of Labor was suggesting that they might try and ask for office space so that they could work on a continual basis with the people that were there. As far as illegal immigrants are concerned, we are very, very conscious of the fact that as soon as somebody arrives in the building, they need to be helped to get to the Department of Home Affairs. And so on a regular weekly basis, from two particular sources, within the building, we've got ourselves organized, that there are people who organize people to get to Crown Mines, and then through our Ecumenical Affairs Ministry, Refugees Ministry, Dr. Emmanuel Ngenzi is a fairly strong advocate who would also help us in trying to get people through to Marabastat to get their papers organized. We have paid considerable amounts of money to get people transported backwards and forwards so that we're not vulnerable in terms of housing illegal immigrants. We are hoping that the partnership with Home Affairs could be strengthened even more. I know that Dr. Emmanuel, who really is the person who does the work for us with regard to refugee status, has a very good relationship with Home Affairs and is often with them. Just as far as the church being empty over Christmas, it wasn't our experience, in actual fact. The church was as full over Christmas as it has been all the time. It's been fairly consistent. In actual fact, I would say that from November to the end of January, we probably had more people coming into our building than usual. I don't understand why, but that certainly did happen. Have I answered all your questions?
No, it's fine. It's fine, Bishop. Thank you very much. Well, my concern, obviously, was around this Home Affairs now. But without any clear, relationship, you may find yourself in that situation again, that the police and the immigration officers will be coming to you and arresting a number of people. Out of the people who were arrested last time, because it was alleged that some of them were criminals, out of the people who were arrested and deported, do you know of any of those who were suspects and are still behind bars, arrested for whatever outstanding, criminal activities?
They found that the warrant was for firearms, ammunition, and criminals. They found no firearms, they found no drugs, and nobody is still behind bars from that thing. Found no criminals.
All right. No. Thank you very much, Bishop. At some point, obviously, we'll pay a visit to come and and then see the work that has been done by the church there. And if it's in that sense, therefore, Bishop, we want to wish you well, and then and deal with the challenges that they are facing us. We, without waste of time, immediately I think we can now ask the UNHCR to make their presentation on the amendment bill, and again to share with the committee the assurance, especially the current developments that are taking place. So on that note, I will then welcome my chief. You'll introduce yourself again.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Abel Mbilinyi, and I work as the Deputy Regional Representative for United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, popularly known as UNHCR. Well, first of all, I must say I'm touched by the opening remarks of the Chair, particularly on what we consider as UNHCR as a reverse trend in terms of the xenophobic attacks on foreigners generally. And our recent experience in Pretoria has shown that even people who are probably second-generation citizens, in the sense that their fathers were from foreign countries, now they are citizens here, were also attacked. In other words, you came from Mozambique, you came from Zimbabwe, you are a foreigner, even if you are a South African citizen. So that facet of development for us is a bit unfortunate. And yesterday, together with the Minister of Home Affairs, I was also in a suburb called Brazzaville in Atrichville, and where we saw quite gruesome pictures, not pictures, people who were burnt alive for no reason other than they were not South Africans. And I think this is unfortunate. I come from a country where we used to welcome South Africans. We still have places called Soweto in my country. We still have places called Frelimo. We still have places called Bulawayo, where we had all these people living in there. And therefore, it is really painful to see that there is a trend where foreigners are being targeted for no reason other than being foreigners. I read the Pretoria news recently. Somebody said, well, we don't want Africans who are not South Africans. And it gave me a really reason to think that South Africans are also Africans. So who is it that they don't want? Now, that said, I must say also, over the past few years, I've taken note of the really great interest and the good work that the Portfolio Committee has been working together with the department, I would say, to improve the lives of refugees and asylum seekers in the country. We have followed with interest the work of the committee at the refugee reception offices in Cape Town, all the way to Bight Bridge and to Maraba Star, to mention quite a few. But I'm also relieved that as we speak now, also a meeting is being held in Pretoria, where the city of Pretoria and the Department of Home Affairs, the UNHCR, and other stakeholders are trying to chart a plan aimed primarily at combating xenophobia within the capital city. I think it gives quite a not a very positive image of the country, that at the seat of the government, at the heart of the government, you have attacks on foreigners. It is just not something which anyone would feel proud of. So I'm quite happy that the department, the highest level, has taken the fight against xenophobia, and the minister herself has said she'll be following up the matter, and she has invited the UNHCR together with its partners to work on this issue. As the previous speaker, I think, from COMSA had said, there's history in South Africa where we had programs to combat xenophobia. Even South Africa had held a summit, a world summit, on xenophobia and other intolerances in Durban. So there's quite a history of this country, and there's a goodwill, I believe, before the meeting I spoke to the chairperson, there's much we can do together to sensitize people to live and cohabit with other people who are in need of protection. That is what I could say on xenophobia, but I think on the issue of the amendment to the Refugee Act, first I must say I would thank really the department, because this process for us has been extremely consultative. In many other countries, normally the government would hand down a law what they want to do, but in South Africa the government has taken the pain to involve a wide consultation of the civil society, government, and the people working with the refugees to streamline, try to amend what is there. One could ask a question: was there anything wrong with the old law which required changes, or do we need to change at all? Because we believe that the old law was generally a good law. Implementation was quite a challenge. But that said, there are also always areas of improvement. And one area of improvement which we thought generally was to try to remove the confusion between the appeal processing bodies, more so between the standing committee and the refugee appeal board. It was very clear on who does what and who goes where in terms of the appeal process. So unifying the two bodies for us was a positive thing, and which UNHCR had always supported, that at least there should be one authority which should be dealing with refugee appeals. So that is something which we believe that it is an improvement which could help to streamline the appeal process. That said, however, it would mean, therefore, to put more resources in one body. And this is a call for UNHCR, that the current structure of the Refugee Appeal Board, which would also be consolidated with the Standing Committee, may require either more specifications of the board. Let me give further explanation. The standing committee was mainly, in our view, dealing with what you may call reviews of abusive and manifestly unfounded cases. In other words, in the old regime, the government had thought if somebody is abusing the system, then they should be dealt very fast and removed out of the system. You don't want an abuser, somebody who is abusing the system, to remain in with a pending appeal for 10 years. So you want that person to be dealt as soon as possible. Now, while we believe that that kind of procedure should still exist, it's not very clear to us that this is provided for under the new law. There's a provision which talks about abusive and fraudulent claims. But if we are not careful, the fraudsters and abusers would still remain enjoying the same kind of advantages as any other person who has a failed refugee claim. So generally, the consolidation of the appeal process is, in our view, a positive situation which the government could take. Now, let me be more specific on the other amendments which we think we can still improve. And our approach as UNHCR is that since the old law was not a bad law, so our approach is we are going to propose a no-harm approach. In other words, to improve more than to damage what is there already. We think the foundation is already good, so we can build on the foundation. We had no quarrels on the definitions. I think the definitions are quite okay, and particularly UNHCR is happy that the marriage is defined to include a valid marriage which is conducted in a foreign country. In other words, the criteria of marriage should also be, is following up the law of marriage in this country, that it is governed by the law of where the marriage took place. So that one we think is a positive step for us. On Section 2, UNHCR had a little bit of quarrels there. And one of the quarrels on the proposed Section 2, which I'll explain very briefly, is that particular Section 2A, the one which is taking the old Section 6 and puts in Section 2A, where the two areas which we believe, again, we can improve. One area is we would like or we propose that the former Section 6, which is saying the Refugee Act would be interpreted in according to international instruments, should be retained as it was. There's just one limitation there, which is saying, which has been dropped, which is the former, I believe, the former Section 60E, which was saying it should be interpreted in according to other treaties which South Africa is a part of, becomes a party, is now proposed to be dropped. We think there's no harm in retaining the former Section 6 as it was, because it can also serve Parliament to come again and revise it. If again there's another important instrument which South Africa will become a party, which is not foreseen now. So we thought that is a less harmful proposal to make. The other proposal is that in respect of Section 2A was that we don't see why it should be said the interpretation should be in conformity with the Immigration Act. We thought that specifically where Immigration Act is applicable under the Act, it has been specified. For example, under the proposed Section 36, where we say, okay, if you have failed your application, Immigration Act would apply. So there's no need again to say interpretation should be in accordance with the Immigration Act, because where it will be applicable is specifically said so. And therefore we thought there's a redundancy in that one. So the trade-off is to put back the Section 6 as it was, because that was the intention, and remove or delete reference to Immigration Act, which again is in a do-no-harm approach. It harms nobody. It is already provided specifically where the Immigration Act would apply. Again, after that, we thought that Section 3A, we welcome basically inclusion of gender-related persecution. In other words, including gender into one of the grounds for recognition, even though it's a positive trend. I believe South Africa will be one of the countries in the world, one of the first countries to specifically include gender-related persecution. It's an issue which UNHCR has been advocating for, and one of the examples is in many countries, gender-related persecution would benefit women rather than men. And therefore, we thought that is a positive step. However, it's not a trade-off, but we believe that the definition of race, ethnicity, or membership of a particular group covers tribe. So if we delete tribe under that definition, we don't lose anything because the tribe is actually a subdivision of ethnicity. So in that case, or even race in some cases, or even a membership of a particular group. So if the word tribe is deleted, then it's actually a no loss, no gain. It's something which is, we thought it can just it can just be as good if it's deleted. However, it's not a point we would like to insist as UNHCR. A tribe in African context gives more clarity. But one would say, why not put a clan, which in Somalia would give no more clarity? Why not keep a caste, which in India would give more clarity? So, in other words, we believe that if the definition of tribe is removed, it doesn't harm the act. Although it's for the wisdom of members to see whether this is the case. Further down, we also believe that Section 3C, which is quite an important section, there for us is a question of recognizing that either a dependent of a refugee is a refugee as well. In practice, our quarrel was a practice, that in practice we believe that some officials, not a general rule, some officials were confused by this section. And it led to a situation where in some cases you found a husband is recognized, a wife is rejected. And therefore, it jeopardizes the harmony of a family unit. And then we have brought these cases. They are not many. But the likelihood, the fact that it has happened, it doesn't exclude that it may happen again. So we wanted really to look, and our wish is that there's an anomaly in application of that section, which could be clarified in the regulations. So it doesn't have to be legislated. So we make no particular proposal there. But we want to bring to attention of the department that the issue of derivative status has at times not been applied correctly in the country. And therefore, one of the major recommendations related to derivative status on our side was to amend Section 38, which makes for the rules. In that case, we wanted to cater a situation of family reunification. If, for example, if a Congolese husband came to South Africa this year and the wife would join next year, then the department is sometimes obliged the wife to apply for refugee status, with the consequence that, oh, but you just came here to join your husband, you are not a refugee. Huh? In that case, then legally the director general will be obliged to put the wife at Lindela and deport her while protecting the husband here. So we want the regulations to clarify this situation, particular situations of family reunification of family members who are not in South Africa. Now there's what the people in law call a lacuna, there's a kind of a gap which it's not regulated. So it is always very difficult, even for embassies or U.S. South African representation abroad to deal with the cases of family unification. But if the law here had clarified on how a foreign dependent or spouse can reunify with a refugee, then it will be quite an important development for the preservation of family unity. The other amendment which we thought would be quite as important is that on Section 4. Section 4 is proposing basically to say if a person, let's say if a Congolese is recognized as a refugee in Zimbabwe and comes to South Africa, then that person should be excluded from refugee status. It looks reasonable that, look, Zimbabwe has the same obligation as South Africa to protect refugees. However, UNHCR also recognizes that in certain cases, a person may be obliged to leave another country for security reasons. And therefore, a statutory exclusion of a person who has been recognized as a refugee in another country would really be an issue which would offer less protection to people who would be leaving countries for security reasons. Let me take an example at home. If this would be the case, South Africans who fled to Swaziland and then went to Mozambique, then Mozambique would say you are not refugees because you should have been protected in Swaziland. And we know that sometimes at that time the arms of South Africa were greater in Swaziland than they were in Mozambique. So for protection reasons, those people would be obliged to leave to another country. And in such a case, a third country has a right to determine a refugee status on its own and say you are a refugee in South Africa or not. So the proposal by UNHCR is that while we believe that if you got permanent residence in another country, you shouldn't be recognized as a refugee here, but the mere fact that you are recognized as a refugee should not exclude you from refugee status. It's an important recommendation for UNHCR in terms of exclusion of refugees from refugee status. It's also in line with the executive committee recommendation that when refugees move from one country to another, another country should determine refugee status. In terms of Section 8, we still believe that the capacity building, in other words, the training which was provided for under the former Act, should still be retained somehow. I think one of the major problems we are facing is the turnout of staff. Staff move around, and the turnout. We have noted also that the staff have not been been recruited without proper training. Although the current Act is saying experienced and trained staff, but I think training also should be a responsibility for the government. And we don't want training to be lost in terms of the Refugee Act. So we were worried about training, and we believe it can either be put in the regulations of the government to train people or substantively like it was previously in the Act. In other words, the government should be able to enforce its own capacity building. The other issue which we are a bit worried is the question of appeals which are normally brought up on agent basis. I think even in the legal system here, you can bring up an urgent application in a court, and then in such a case it would be believed that in terms of appeal, a procedure for urgent appeals in which the quorum can be reduced should be provided for. Mainly to prevent people from being deported. So in order to prevent an unlawful deportation, an emergency appeal process with a reduced quorum should be provided for. We have also noted that currently there are about 6 members of the appeal board, and when I looked at their submission, 6,000 appeals are pending. Now, this is a lifetime activity. If you hear maybe 2 appeals a day, so it calls for a question of enlarging the appeal authority. The proposed appeal authority membership should be enlarged. This can be done in 2 ways. One way is, of course, you have a big appeal authority based in Pretoria and deploy staff everywhere. The other one is to create what I may call regional appeal authorities. In other words, the Cape Town should have an appeal authority which will deal with the Cape Townian cases. But working under the same direction of the chair of the appeal authority. We have not given a careful thought on how it would function, what is the financial implications, but this could be one way of preventing backlogs, which may be endless backlogs at the appeal level. In other words, since a person who has lost in the first instance could be back as an asylum seeker, and if there's a huge backlog, then you may find out another problem where you have people who are asylum seekers indefinitely. And that may not be really a good thing. So for me, it's an issue of resources to the appeal board or appeal authority. And the second one is trying to decentralize the appeal authority and provide the services where the reception centers are. But whether it can be legislated, this one is an issue which, again, the wisdom of the House can decide. But it's something which we think, in order to prevent a situation where you have endless backlogs of appeal, then the strengthening of the authority is important. We noted also under Section 21 that the refugee reception office's powers have been scrapped. In other words, that institution called the refugee reception office is gone. It has pros and cons. However, at the same time, we see that these powers are consolidated in the Refugee Status Determination Office. And as we have noted as well, the Refugee Status Determination Office becomes a queue manager. Now, the main function of a Refugee Status Determination Officer is to determine applications, not to manage queues. And these Refugee Status Determination Officers will be managing queues or doing a lot of administrative work, their productivity would be zero. And therefore, we will have situations like we are having now of huge backlog of asylum applications. And therefore, while we do not necessarily say the Refugee Status Determination or the Refugee Reception Officers should be reinstated, we believe that a designated person should be there to manage access, to manage queues. It could be an administrator, it could be or whatever title you mean, but this function should not be vested on a person who is going to determine who is a refugee and who is not a refugee. On Section 21B, and I thought that was a major section. Section 21B contains a proviso which gives and a concept of good faith spousal relationship. I wanted the committee to give a careful thought about this one in view of Section 10 of the Constitution and also on Section 14. We are talking of right to privacy and the right to dignity. I believe if I was Director General directed to ensure that there is good faith spousal relationship, I would be asking a lot of intimate questions on the couple for 2 years. Where have you sleeping? How have you sleeping? What's the size of your whatever? So you can imagine all those questions could be, some of them may be extremely embarrassing, because how else would the Director General be satisfied that there's a good spousal relationship if he's not allowed to invade on the privacy of a family? In other words, we are inviting the Director General to really map out the bedrooms of everybody and ask intimate questions. This, I believe that there's good intention to ensure that at least people do not engage in marriages of convenience. That probably is the good intention which was intended by the proviso. That is at the expense of invading the privacy of asylum seekers and refugees, and the other, even nationals, if you are married to a national. So UNHCR believes that further reflection be made on the proviso to Section 21B in view of the constitutional rights to privacy and dignity of asylum seekers and whoever would be a spouse of a refugee. And our proposal is simple. If we deleted that section, then we relieve the Director General of the duty to invade the privacy of others. I'm putting it in a human rights language, but basically it's also relieving a Director General to establish a very elaborate, cumbersome procedure in which he has to be satisfied that a good faith spousal relationship existed for 2 years. That is a major issue for us, and we would like the committee to really look at it quite carefully. We have already spoken about Section 22, the RCDOs becoming like queue managers, which I think it is something undesirable. And our recommendation there, as you said, is we would like the RCDO to be relieved of administrative work. The section is written very passively, saying the RSDO should refer a person to another person who is going to give a document. That kind of procedure means he must manage the queues, he must manage the access. So we want him not to be engaged in that issue. Now, I've also listened to members when they were making comments on other presentations, and one of the strongest issues we would like also to advocate in terms of Section 22.3 is that the renewals of asylum permits is a cumbersome procedure. Now, the best way is to determine the refugee status instead of renewing the asylum permit every time. You determine the status immediately. However, the reality is that we have a backlog and we are a long way to reaching that situation. For me, two issues there. One is I've visited a lot of Home Affairs offices. The person making appointments or renewing the does not have a diary in front of them. In other words, it's renewed without fixing a date for hearing of a case. And the law always said the next appointment should either be a result of a hearing or decision. So I would like us to tie down the either be extending the period or fixing a period within which a permit should be renewed. When I lived in Switzerland, the Swiss authorities give a learner's driving permit once in your lifetime, and it is valid for 1 year. So if you apply for learning, you should use a whole year to learn. Now, I'm not saying we should use the Swiss clock here. I'm just saying, at least if we are going to put the renewal period of permits, and I'm proposing here, it's arbitrary, but based on a previous law which was emphasizing that an application should be terminated within 180 days. So if, for example, we say a permit should be renewed for 6 months, to be realistic, it makes the life of everybody easier. A lot of queues at home affairs every 2 months are related to renewal of permits. And it may also relieve and then even be more realistic to say a person who doesn't renew a permit within that period would have a permit abandoned. So for me, if a period is fixed, it would help. Our proposal, therefore, for Section 22 are threefold. First, we wanted to put a time limit within which a refugee claim must be determined. If, for example, we say refugee status must be determined within 365 days, which is 1 year, then we can give only one renewal of a permit, which is 6 months, and then a claim should be determined. In practice, in the beginning, it may be a bit cumbersome, but in looking forward in future, and after the regulations are made, it might be easier that way. And therefore, a person who doesn't take time once in a year to renew a permit should certainly be treated as abandoned. But if we say renewals are every day, and sometimes they fall on Sundays, so it becomes quite cumbersome to do that. And another recommendation in Section 22 relates to 22.7. 22.7 for us seems to be, it creates a crime or an offense which is already catered for under Section 37. So again, on a no-harm approach, if you delete Section 22.7, it doesn't harm anybody because that offense is already offense under the catalog of offenses under Section 37. I've already spoken about the abusive claims, and the plea for UNHCR there is to have under the legislation the accelerated procedure for asylum process. Accelerated procedures can work in two ways. One, in favor of a strong refugee claim. You have a very strong refugee claim, you can ask that claim to be accelerated so that the person's status is not in limbo for longer than necessary. The second aspect of that is you can accelerate abusive claims, which the old term was manifestly unfounded claim. So there are two ways. The procedure can be used both to cater for very strong refugee claims. Once a claim form is in front of you, you say this is a very good case and this person should be recognized immediately. And secondly, you can cater also for cases which are quite very weak or no refugee cases at all. And that accelerated procedure, in our view, should be instituted, and more so in quite strong terms. And this would help the department to deal with a lot if not, if I take the rejection rate now, is around 70% of cases are rejected. And maybe of the 70 cases, 50% could be dealt in a very fast manner. And there, as UNHCR, we are also ready to work with the department to look into detail on how accelerated procedures could be employed. And again, Section 24A5, we thought it needed some kind of clarity. And we believe it's a typographical error, really, Section 24.5, because it talks about if there are new elements at the appeal, then the appeal authority sends back the case to the RSDO to deal with it in terms of the Immigration Act. So I think it is clearly an error there. It should certainly be in terms of the Refugees Act, because if there are new elements relevant to the claim, then it means there's a second chance for an applicant to be heard again by the Refugee Status Determination Officer and not to be sent for deportation. There's no other procedure under the Immigration Act which will deal with the Refugee Status Determination. So for us there, we think it's a printing error which can easily be rectified. Although if left as it is, it might create a lot of confusion to the Refugee Status Determination Officer. And I believe that's the easiest concession the department can make, because it's a printing error there. Going to Section 27, which we believe is a very critical section, and I've had the advantage of quickly perusing through other submissions, particularly from the AIDS Law Project and THC, again, on a do-no-harm approach. We believe that if the former Section 27G, which relates to health services, access to health services, is retained, it only would clarify the legal position of institutions that provide health care to asylum seekers. Some of them who are probably people caught like in Bishop Verin's church in such a cases. And therefore it would avoid a situation, as we say here, which would criminalize assistance to some people in South Africa. So again, to specify, although one can argue that if you have rights under the Constitution and a Bill of Rights, all those rights are enumerated, but the real challenge which refugees have on access to health or health care would entail that section to be retained. There's again no harm in retaining it, but there's more harm in removing it from the Act. Even we also noted that the right to study has been removed there. So again, if it is only added away, the right to employment and study, it only clarifies matters for refugees who want to pursue education in the country. So those are the two proposals, but one of the most important ones for us is to clearly restate the right of the universal primary education to children. I mean, that right is not only a refugee right, it's a right that has the right of the Convention of the Child. And if it is silent, sometimes silence means no, at times it means yes. So it may be left to people to interpret it the way they want. You know, it's not provided there, so it's not there. But others say it's not provided there, it's not prohibited there, it's there. But in this case, if it is specifically provided, we think it is it will be all right. So right to study should be included, right to primary education and access to particularly public health care. These are important rights to all asylum seekers in the country. On Section 27AA, I think capital A and A, we are again repeating the recommendation there to say documents to refugees should have really a duration which is quite important for them. Currently, refugee documentation are valid for no more than 2 years. They don't help very much, and I think time which is longer than 2 years, and maybe because of other provisions, less than 5 years would be an important duration for validity of refugee documentation. That goes as well to Section 30. We have, for example, getting a document itself, once you are recognized, sometimes you make an application. By the time you get your document, it's sometimes valid for a couple of months. But if the duration was more than 2 years, you will have at least more than 2 years of enjoying your status. Again, a longer period of a document reduces the administrative work at Home Affairs, reduces abuses also, which are also conducted by some Home Affairs staff, also reduces the temptations of refugees to bribe Home Affairs staff in order to accelerate their documentation processing. So there are more advantages to give a longer period than to limit. We are at this stage, therefore we are proposing that a refugee document should be valid for at least 3 years, if not 5. 3 years is quite is a conventional document. It's a conventional time. 5 years is also a good period because after 5 years, then the department can look closely whether a person is here as a refugee for a future or not. The other proposal, which may be quite a tall order, is to align the refugee documentation with national documents. If, for example, we give a document which is not easy for the police to tear down, right? As some person said, police sometimes tear down papers. If a document is not easy to destroy, it offers only more protection to refugees. And for me, I think that should be the way forward, rather than an A4 paper, which now is quite a document for identification. It's not widely known in the country, and it's easy also to lose. It comes rain, it can be destroyed. It comes sunshine, it may be destroyed as well. The last substantive comment we wanted to propose is to carefully look, and we are not looking in the eyes of a criminal lawyer or something, to carefully look at Section 37. The Section 37 for us looks like an omnibus section. It creates a lot of offenses, a lot. Some serious, some not so serious. Some of them are offenses which can only be committed by staff of Home Affairs, some of them by refugees. And they all attract the same punishment. I don't know. Maybe in terms of fairness, one can look closely whether corruption should attract the same thing than failure to report to a Home Affairs office. So that's the issue which we wanted to see whether the department can unpack the offense section and see whether they can also rationalize why the kind of same treatment is treated to all offenses. Indeed, whatever infraction is committed may be wrong, but in the laws of sentencing, serious offenses should attract this serious punishment, and the less crimes should attract lesser punishment as well. Chairperson, I would stop here, and again, thank you very much to the committee for giving UNHCR this opportunity.
No, thank you very much, sir, for your presentation, more detailed presentation of this. Can I get members? I can see they are ready for action. But can you take the format again, the line format? No? Followed by Bukman and Kozi.
Chairperson,
are you going to speak, Father Matel?
Unfortunately, you called me to ask questions.
No, no. No, please. No, so please, I'm just trying to get the format of the man in which you ask questions. No, I've given you a wait first. I was asking if he's going to speak because I wanted to have a format, the man in which you ask questions, take it through the line. No, no, please, can you ask your question?
Thank you.
I know that can be an issue now. And I don't want you to walk out of the meeting today.
I'll promise you I won't.
All right, no, yes.
As long as you give me a chance to speak, I will not walk out of your meeting, Chairperson. Chairperson, thank you, and could I just thank you as well, Mr. Mbilinyi. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much indeed. You've shown us this morning that you really know the Act, and thank you very much indeed for taking it through us through it in such a detailed manner. I just want to concentrate on three areas, and could I just preface my remarks by saying, certainly from my perspective, I understand that law is written for the ideal situation. You write a law for utopia, but for the ideal situation. In South Africa, we have less than an ideal situation. As you well know, we have porous borders. We have a Department of Home Affairs that in many respects is dysfunctional. If not, it is just simply not working. There are many, many problems. And I just, in three areas, I wanted to just ask you to just perhaps explain a little more about why you think we should do certain things. The first is the Section 21 on page 4 of your submission, the recommendation that Section 21B should be deleted. The question, the concept of good spousal relationships versus the right to privacy and dignity. And I just want to ask you, perhaps we're not being a little bit naive in wanting to just do away with that situation, in accepting in good faith individuals' reasons for seeking asylum. The only experience I can give is the experience of the United Kingdom, where I know that there is certainly very intense scrutiny and investigation of couples seeking asylum or residency or whatever you want to call it on the basis of being married and the so-called marriages of convenience. I accept absolutely your reasons given. You make a very good case for saying that there's no room for this. It offends our constitution. But the reality, certainly, in a country like the United Kingdom, which has very much more solid borders and a Home Affairs Department, etc., aren't we being a little naive? How do we manage that situation? The second point was around 22.3 on page 5, which dealt with specifying a specific period which the new permit should be valid for, and you used the Swiss example. And again, I just want to ask again, are we not just being a little naive? Switzerland is a country that works in just about every respect. Some people would even call it boring because it works so well. If you know who's in the country, who's out the country, who's left, who's coming in. The Department of Home Affairs has a fingerprint and an ID and everything of every single person. They can go and find them if something is wrong. We are completely in a different situation. And again, I would ask, how could you just clarify or defend your point? I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, sir. I'm just simply putting the case that says, how do we justify these things? And then finally, on page 6 of your submission, you talk about, I think it's section 27, yes, specifically the access to health services. And again, in a perfect world, I would absolutely agree with you that any person coming to this country seeking asylum, whatever, should have access to our health services. But I don't have to tell you that our health services are under severe pressure. Many instances, they are simply falling apart. You just have to go to parts of the Eastern Cape. How on earth are we going to justify people's rights to health care when these people in South Africa, in many instances, cannot access those same health services, which, funnily enough, or ironically enough, are guaranteed in our constitution. So
everything is falling apart, Mr. Lowe.
for this meeting will fall apart if you keep interrupting me, sir, with great respect. Thank you, I'm done now.
That was never a bad, I'm telling you.
Thanks, Chair. Two issues. You made mention of members of the appeal board sitting on their own to deal with applications. I'm in agreement, but then I think there should be one provider that those members should be properly legally qualified. And I think the present, let's say, definition in the Act is inadequate. So I think that's maybe an issue we should look at as we discuss this matter next week. Then on the conceptual level, and you know, you're from the High Commissioner and you're looking at worldwide at the issues. I'm not talking about, you know, big issues of refugees in the Sudan or Lebanon or whatever. My question is, we've got the situation where the government deals with individuals. My question is there any examples of countries where working with NGOs, churches and so on are also part of the regime? In terms of the regulations or the Act. I just want to know, because at the end of the day, we're saying, okay, the department is responsible, there's appeal authority, the individual, do the application. BSS may, but in practice, that is not the situation. In practice, you've got a whole coalition of NGOs, churches, yourself involved. Now, do we leave those institutions out of the Act totally for the regulations, or are they just an add-on? My question is there any, in terms of benchmarking, examples in the world where you operate as an institution, where that relationship is much more formalized, can you maybe just give us an indication?
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, let me correct the statement of saying Department of Home Affairs have got a lot of problems. Home Affairs does not have problems, Chairperson. It has got a lot of challenges, not problems, Chairperson. From the presenter, Chairperson, you are talking about the conventions. I just want to find out who's supposed to do monitoring on the conventions, Chairperson. Secondly, you are talking about the question of appeals on emergency basis. In terms of court procedure, Chairperson, any emergency case is controlled by agency. If you don't qualify for agency, you won't succeed for the agency appeals, Chairperson. I just want to find out the view from the presenter as a qualified person, because some of the challenges of Home Affairs is the delays by the embassy to identify their national at the reception center, whether it's a refugee or illegal immigrant, Chairperson. And another challenge is, Chairperson, where I want to hear from the presenter, his views with regard to ministerial degree has also been received to allow for the crossing of international borders. I want advice, Chairperson, from the presenter, Chairperson.
I think that your question on the second, the one on the embassy, is about the deportation. Lindela, that's about it, because that's where the embassies come in.
Even those who are applying for, sometimes they need
no, the asylums, they don't call the embassies, because they don't want to see them, because they're running away from those embassies. Okay, so I think it's about the yes, what?
They was going to walk away if you don't.
No, he does not have a choice anymore. He can't walk away. This party is going to punish him this time.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, from my own observation, it is mostly the churches and other non-governmental organizations that are providing assistance to refugees and asylum seekers in terms of funds, clothing, and other things. And I've seen in other countries where the United Nations High Commission for Refugees were assisting asylum seekers. I was one. And there was this thing called Mupando, where they were giving out food and other things.
From China, just imagine you wearing a suit from China.
But I haven't seen such things in South Africa. So I just want to know from you, so how are they providing these asylum seekers in South Africa? Mm-hmm. How are they assisting them? Not only in helping us to draw nice acts for them, but physically.
The role of the UNHCR. The role of UNHCR in South Africa, where we don't have refugee camps. So how do they come in? And, okay, no, that's fine. The answer. I think you've done it before, but you'll have to answer again. And before you sort of come in, the Section 26B of the Immigration Act on the good spousal relationship, if you have looked at it, I think you'll see that it's already in operation. And why would we give, you know, this good spousal relationship for South Africans, and when it comes to asylum seekers or refugees, we have to do away with it? Why is it unconstitutional on those bases? As you respond to the first question, which is asked by law, I think you can sort of elaborate more on that part. Because already it does exist in the Immigration Act.
Kevin, I think I'll attempt to answer some questions extremely difficult, but let me start with what I may consider to be an easy one, and that's the role of UNHCR. I think two questions were asked there. One was the monitoring of conventions, and the one was what does UNHCR do, actually, particularly where you have no refugee camp. And related to that one again is the role of government, why not NGOs and all this stuff. In South Africa, we have been in South Africa for not so many years, but about 15 years, I think. And the first role of UNHCR was purely technical, just to convince South Africa after the new dispensation to ratify instruments which protect the refugees. That was the primary role. After that, the role of UNHCR was again changed. We helped Mozambicans return home. And after the Mozambicans, then South Africa started receiving people. By 2000, there were about 30,000 asylum seekers in South Africa, and the UNHCR worked with the department on a backlog project, which was fully financed by UNHCR to help clear the backlog of asylum seekers. We may call it Backlog Project 1. And after that, there were even more people who came, more than 100,000 came, so South Africa became more attractive. Again, we worked with the Home Affairs in terms of clearing the backlog and providing advice, training. I think we are one of the major trainers of Home Affairs in terms of refugee law, etc., etc. In terms of assistance, indeed, we have a network of 13 refugee organizations, and which are working in many, many areas. We have a cluster working on health, particularly issues of HIV/AIDS. We have people giving social assistance. However, since asylum seekers and refugees have a right to work and study in South Africa, our assistance has been limited to very vulnerable people. In other words, we do not want, once you come to South Africa, you know, you're entitled to a UNHCR assistance automatically. No. There's a vulnerability criteria which we apply. And extremely vulnerable people are assisted for only a couple of months. And also part of our assistance is not only to reduce the vulnerability, but to help such a person to integrate into the community, start up capitals and all this stuff. It's a limited assistance. And our assistance doesn't touch the majority of asylum seekers in the country. Currently, for last year, for example, out of the close to 100,000, our assistance extended to less than 20,000 vulnerable people who are judged vulnerable, 20,000. However, we don't do it directly. We do it with the partners. In Cape Town, we have people working in the law firms like the University of Cape Town Law Clinic, which we finance lawyers there. We also have people working in the assistance area, like Cape Town Refugee Center. We have Bon Esperance, which is also a shelter for women, which the portfolio committee has visited Bon Esperance, the Zaki facility there. And in other cities, we also have a similar arrangement. So we are working also with the church organization. Last year, we also worked closely with the refugee ministries, which is implementing the Bishop of Verins project as well, to alleviate the suffering of people in terms of small non-food items rather than food. Towards the end of the year, we were engaged with the food assistance to vulnerable Zimbabweans around Gauteng area. So but we do not want, as the United Nations, to substitute ourselves either for the government or for the local NGOs. That's not the role of the United Nations, really. We are more on advisory capacity, technical support, rather than doing things ourselves. Even, I don't know whether you were in Dukwi or you were in Mayukwayukwa or wherever you were before, but even there, UNHCR worked through partners and the government. We don't want ourselves to substitute ourselves. That brings me to the question of the supervisory function of UNHCR in terms of the convention. With respect to the Refugee Convention, UNHCR has two functions there. One is to cooperate with the government. That's why we cooperate with the Home Affairs here. And secondly, it's not only innocent cooperation. We will advise if things are going wrong. We'll say, here, things are going wrong. Take remedial measures. We will do that as well. So the monitoring of the implementation of conventions is part of UNHCR activities, which is not easy. It's not like distributing food. You don't see it, but it's a function which we are engaged on a day-to-day basis. With the government here. And we also not only deal with Home Affairs, we deal with the Department of Health, Education, Social Development, and the other departments as well, in terms of looking at the various spectrum of the refugee lives. I take note of the use of the terminology challenges rather than the problems. I think it's good to see a problem as a challenge. That's all I can say. It's really good to see that you are challenged by a problem rather than you have a problem there. And I believe the issue of embassies involved with the protection of their own people is an issue which we should separate, as the chair pointed out, between embassies involved in identification of people who have been considered either as illegal foreigners in the country and the people who qualify for refugee status. In effect, it would be inconsistent for an embassy or for a Zimbabwe ambassador to go to Marabastad and check who is a refugee there. Because an ambassador, for example, represents the president of the country. If you are running away from that person, then the ambassador would identify you here, and then your security would be jeopardized. In that case, I think UNHCR would even take issue if an embassy is visiting refugee reception centers every day. We may asking foreign affairs whether this has become an employee of home affairs or what. It's an inconsistent, actually, for ambassador, except in context of voluntary repatriation, to be involved with their own people, who, by definition, a refugee would have lost the protection of his own country, and now is under protection of South Africa. But in terms of processes of removal of illegal foreigners, indeed the embassies are engaged there, because you don't want to deport a Zimbabwean to Tanzania. So there you, the embassies have an issue there. I also understand that there are lots of initiatives related to either cross-border movements like the SADC Protocol Freedom Movement, but within the refugee context, I know they have a bearing. For example, if there's more regular freedom of movement between countries, then probably the need for some people using asylum process would be minimized. I take an example where I come from in East Africa, where the Kenya deporting Ugandans and Tanzanians all the time. And it reached a stage where the Kenyans found out that they were using a lot of money for deportation of people who would come back the next day. But within the East Africa freedom of movement issue, which a visa of 6 months was permitted, then the deportation is stopped. You can borrow a leaf from some of those countries sometimes and stop processes like Valindera going every day to Bedouin.
But the problem that you're not addressing, sorry to come in, because I want us to deal with this one, the issue of documentation. I mean, you look at Zimbabwe, and I've raised this thing before. Zimbabwe and Mozambique cannot, in fact, it takes 5 years to get a passport if you're a Zimbabwean. Same applies with Mozambicans. Even if we have this waiving of the visa fee for a month or 3 months, same applies with Lesotho. Lesotho does not even give passports. It gives a A4 with a photo, and that gets photocopied all the time and stamped. Now, the issue of documentation becomes very critical, because even if those who want to come legal in the country, they don't have documentation, therefore they then opt to this illegal, you know, crossing of the borderline and all of that. And I mean, that's why I wanted to hear that part coming in, so that, you know, the responsibility is not only on South African, you know, deportees. It's not a good thing. In fact, this thing of deporting people all the time. The problem is that the documentation, we have visited Mozambique, we've been to Zimbabwe, Namibia, we're planning to go to the Congo, and we're going to the Congo, in fact, because there are other people who are criticizing the committee when we have to do this work. Now, part of our engagement was around the SADC protocol on a facilitation of free movement and goods, you know. And obviously, it will be important to hear your view. But again, as you do that, it's important to hear your view around the condition. Put aside the xenophobic attacks that we are now going to be dealing with and we are dealing with. The general support to those who have qualified for refugee status in South Africa. It comes to, because I can hear you advocating, and not only yourself, but people are saying that a number of presenters were saying that we must be explicit of the rights that as asylum seekers your entitlements may be health, education and what. But I will say to you that currently in this country, a number of refugees, asylum seekers, even illegal immigrants, they have access. As much as law may say that our health system is collapsing. Either it's under budgeted for, therefore, because of this influx. And the fact that we have over 3 to 4 million people who are in South Africa who happen to be either refugees or asylum seekers. It's important when we engage around these issues, we give that international perspective, and so that we are not, in fact, singling ourselves as a country that has these challenges or problems, as you may put it, as if nothing is being done. I think it's important to reflect on those issues. Therefore, we can then be able to pin down areas where we need really serious attention and to focus on.
Thanks, Chair, and I thank you for raising the issue of numbers, because for me, if you look at the numbers, South Africa is less than 40,000 refugees, recognized refugees, in a population of 47 million. Yeah, less.
Yes, true.
So it's not even 1 million. Tanzania has a population of 600,000 recognized refugees. So when we talk of numbers, then probably we can say, are we really facing a challenge which we cannot surmount? That would be the question I would like to ask. I think we probably are not facing a challenge which is an insurmountable challenge. Secondly...
No, listen, why can't you leave him to speak? And then once you finish, then you can...
Secondly, if you look at health, and I'll take of Johannesburg General Hospital. At one time, it was asking 1,800 rand for every visit of an asylum seeker. At the same time, asking about 50 rand for a national. Now... these prohibitive kind of access fees meant asylum seekers will only end up at Bishop Verin's clinic rather than going anywhere else. But in that case, while we are saying refugees should not be exempt to pay fees, we should say reasonableness should be applied. And this case really... again, with the challenges of the work which asylum seekers face, by some administrative kind of hurdles, we might be actually refusing a refugee to be treated. Let me speak probably as a health worker. I'm not, but let me speak as a health worker. If we were to say, and I'll take that... a refugee who is suffering from contagious TB, for example, should not be treated. The person would board a bus, and maybe TB, the locals would get TB. So if you are not treating this very small person, or a single person, you are actually doing a disservice to your own people as well. So the universality of some of the services would call for a more, I would say, rational way or rational approach in dealing with the issues of health. I am aware, and I've visited this country in many locations, I'm aware of the disparity of the challenges in terms of access to employment, access to health, and access to what. But access to education, for example, a child, why should a child be denied education? Those are issues which would say, yeah, it's not really only a responsibility as a government, but it's a responsibility as a part of the humanity. If the same treatment was given to all refugees, it would mean really we are violating basic rights of people. And I think under the, and we are sitting here at the seat which is a kind of buildings where a very good constitution was murdered out, we shouldn't throw away the constitution. That is all what I would say. We shouldn't throw away this nice constitution and apply it selectively. While at the same time, as a health example I've said, we would be affected by failure to provide services to such a person. If I look at therefore, the argument for health for me, is it really very difficult to convince somebody that you treat somebody with a contagious disease and you live a foreigner who would be sharing the same facility? It could be HIV, it could be TB, it could be other contagious disease. And that's why we are saying if this right was there before, and with all the challenges of access which were faced by asylum seekers and refugees, the country didn't suffer much, then that right can still be retained. That is the argument we are making. That right can still be retained without harming the infrastructure of the country. And it's the same country, unfortunately, which will be answering every year, why did you remove right of refugees to primary education, which is a universal right under the Convention of the Charter? This would not be a UNHCR asking. It would be the Convention of Human Rights. It would be another convention. And we think it's not proper to do that. Now, let me go to documentation. Documentation can be simplified. I've seen, for example, in Zambia, which is a neighboring, it's not so much distant. Zambia, they also accept this abridged kind of documentation with a passport, with a photo, and all this stuff. As long as there could be kind of cross-border working arrangement where a particular type of documentation can be recognized. It doesn't have to be a passport. And if a passport takes 5 years to get in Zimbabwe, other forms of identification could be accepted. For people living in borders, for example, I've also lived in cross-border areas. I take your neighboring Swaziland with Mozambique. They have an open day where people move without documentation for a particular time for shopping and come back. If this is encouraged, Botswana also. Okay, I'm not Masaba in Swaziland. That is happening. So already the arrangement which South Africa can learn, but I believe it's the sophistication of South Africa, which sometimes hinders acceptance or practice of these minor issues which can, at the end of the day, be more rationalized. I think it's the sophistication of the country rather than the practice on the ground. And nowadays, sometimes they go to practice. ECOWAS, the West African countries, also had a system of freedom of movement of people. Mm. Although with the wars in Sierra Leone and in Ivory Coast, that freedom is sort of jeopardized. So for me, a reduced level of documentation could help a lot to curb this kind of issues. Here, let me address to the remaining 3-4 questions. I think access to health, I've already advocated for it adequately. In terms of the good faith spousal relationship, indeed, although I argued on a ground of constitutionality, I believe also administratively it is a very cumbersome procedure on how it can be implemented. It remains to see what regulations would be put in place to see how our spousal relationship could be put in place.
Let's find out from the Home Affairs Legal Service.
How it is done at least.
Yeah, no, let's look at the current regulations on the immigration law vis-a-vis section that deals with that section 26B. Do you have anything there that you have put in the regulations under the Immigration Act? Let's leave this one first. Just give them a second. I just want to hear from the. There they go. Yes. Yes, very much. Yes,
yeah, Chair, I'm a bit caught off guard, but I should believe I was discussing with a colleague. We'll need to check the immigration regulations.
Who's doing the regulations? Not yourself. No, legal service is not involved in the regulations. Therefore, that becomes my Bible every day, that, you know, within the regulations, this is what you have put, especially under 26B. If you don't have, okay, you'll come back with it later.
Yeah.
Just you can send someone to go and check. Because by the time we close this meeting, let's get an answer, because it's a very critical issue that we must get a watch for. Okay. And so that everybody who's here can go out satisfied that this matter has been covered under the regulations.
Yeah, we'll do that, Chair.
We'll do that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. But I know also countries like Sweden, which practice the issue of good faith relationship. UK was mentioned as an example. Sweden is another one. But it is indeed an issue which would have to invoke social workers who follow up people for quite 2 years in this case in order to see that there's good faith spousal relationship. But it has also been challenged under the European Court as an infringement of rights of people. So, and South Africa is a party to the European Human Rights Convention. So I think one has to, that's why we said it's a critical issue which can be re-examined, although we are bringing it in the context of refugees. I'm not sure whether if there's comfort with the nationals, I'm not very comfortable with the refugee aspect of it. Now, indeed, marriages of convenience are wrong, but they are everywhere in the world, and they are wrong. And we cannot base something which is wrong as a standard. But it's something which we should be looking at it. In terms of limitation period for putting limits, for example, for determining refugee status, this is not new. In effect, the regulations provide that refugee status must be determined in 180 days. Now, so it's something which already in 1998, 10 years ago, the wise people in the House had said, this is the standard for South Africa. Now, I'm just saying we can reinforce that standard. We can repeat it again and ensure that we provide the resources for refugee status to be determined within this time. It's something which was provided. I think a lot of people have talked about the qualification of authority members. I'm not going to address to that. For me, it was my view, and it's still my view, that if the authority would work as a board, then the minister should be allowed to put qualified citizens who are not necessarily lawyers to be members of the board. But if, on the other hand, the board would work as an individual, then the legal qualification may be important. So for me, that is an open question rather than a question which is closed. And then lastly, I believe that the partnership for protection, I would say partnership for protection between the UN, between the governments and the NGOs, it is certainly a desirable thing. We do not have to legislate about it, but for UNHCR, we have already put in the act that UNHCR can always be invited. But for other NGOs, there's room probably under invitation of any other qualified person under the act. But I'm not sure we should go really say NGOs should be part of the process. Chairperson, I would stop here. Thank you very much.
All right. No, thank you very much, sir. I know always engaging with you, it always brings a number of issues, and always the question will be, what is the UNHCR doing in South Africa? And that is very important, because we expect a lot from yourself, in fact, to be, you know, leading in the number of these challenges as we are confronted with as a country. But without waste of time, I really want to thank you very much. As I said earlier, that the issue of that's critical here, it's around the implementation of the law. Hence, we acknowledge this streamlining, and everybody's like agreeing that there's nothing wrong much about the law. It's how we implement and the capacity of Home Affairs to implement this law, which is a wonderful law, I think. So maybe through this streamlining, we'll be able to get more results. Well, there are a number of issues that you have raised, obviously, in your document. And what we'll do is that they will go per item as you have raised it when we deliberate as a committee and then engage with the department. But at the end of the day, it's up to this committee to look at the recommendations that you have put here. And therefore, the outcome, I think, will be a wonderful outcome that will be satisfied yourself. I know that we have a wonderful relationship, ourselves and the organization. Therefore, this committee is very much in touch with the process on the ground. So we thank you very much and wish you well. So, members, can we, without really wasting much time, we're not going to have lunch at 1 o'clock. I'm told that the members are on a diet today. So lunch is arranged for 2 o'clock. So we also want to finish. We just left with two presenters. After that, everybody will then move and have lunch, and then meaning that that will be the end of our public hearing. So it's better to end them with a wonderful lunch. Which range today?
90.3.
We walk almost 2 kilometers for lunch. So can we now invite Legal Resources Center? Then from there, after your presentation, we'll then take the 8th law project. We have done this because we know that they're locally based. So I know that the people from Johannesburg, to spend 2 days in Cape Town is very hard. So he wants to leave immediately after here. So can we then give you, Mr. William, to make your second presentation? And I hope that it will be a very brief one. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Legal Resources, I'm William Kirkwood from the Legal Resources Centre, which is a public interest law clinic. It provides legal services for vulnerable and marginalised communities in South Africa, and it is making this submission on behalf of asylum seekers and refugees who are quite clearly amongst the most vulnerable and marginalised groups in the country. The LRC has considerable experience in acting for and representing asylum seekers and refugees, which is it has done since about 1996. These submissions, Chairperson, are largely made by Advocate Richard Moultrie of the Johannesburg Bar and Janet Love, who is the National Director of the Legal Resources Centre, and the opportunity to address the Portfolio Committee is welcomed. We're very grateful for that. Chairperson, as you've just indicated, the one constant theme from yesterday and today in effectively every submission has been the dissonance between the Constitution, the Fine Refugees Act, and the implementation of both of them. It's really sad that there's been a necessity really for this amendment and a feeling that perhaps the amendment is going to replace the need for implementation of what is there. The amendment is not going to solve the challenges or the problems of the Department of Home Affairs, and one has to not lose sight of that for a moment. The other eerie and disconcerting issue, which has come through almost every presentation, has been the echo from the past, the role of officials and the role of police. We heard Bishop Varain invoking John Forster Square. Chairperson, the role of many officials in the Department for Home Affairs has been that of the former influx control commissioners who denied South Africans the right to come into cities and who enforced appalling laws in an appalling manner. And the Department of Home Affairs must be astute not to adopt the mantle of the old commissioners and their staff. We've seen this in the criminalisation, which has been spoken about today, of asylum seekers. And, in fact, the provisions for being brought before a magistrate in that are worse than that of people accused of rape or murder or multiple murder, robbery and rape. It's just unacceptable that bona fide asylum seekers find themselves criminalised. I was surprised to hear that in Johannesburg there's only a 2-month delay for the processing of a Section 22 permit, Chairperson, that's actually not bad. That's an enormous improvement over many years and an improvement on the situation at present in Cape Town, which has also improved, but only recently. And I'm concerned that, again, there seems to be a feeling that this issue with asylum seekers and refugees has only arisen because of the influx of people from the Democratic Republic of Congo and from Zimbabwe recently. This has been a problem of many years standing, and people have tried to have the Department of Home Affairs address it without success. On the 11th of September 2001, the day of the World Trade Center matter, I was at Home Affairs all morning saying, please, just adopt a slightly more sensible strategy for asylum seekers. Don't leave them without any redress, without the Section 22s to which they are entitled in terms of the Act, because of your lack of capacity and your insistence on unnecessary regulation. The issue was a small suggestion. Instead of requiring asylum seekers to come back to have their Section 22 permits processed every 3 months, make it 6 months, make it 9 months, and then you'll both be able to do your work, you will have less of a burden, and you'll be able to attend to people who have not yet got Section 22 permits. It was like talking to a brick wall. And with variations on that theme, we have come to a situation where in 2005, cases were launched in Cape Town and in Gauteng to get structural interdicts to make Home Affairs attend to recent arrivals. And they're not so recent. Many of them struggle without documentation, in danger of being arrested at any moment, for over a year. And the court in the Cape has 3 times made an order. It's made 3 judgments in a structural interdict, telling Home Affairs to get its house in order, to come back and report some sort of progress to the court. And the progress until October last year has been minimal, and that progress has been diluted or compromised by the attitude of the immigration officials and the Department of Home Affairs in conjunction with the police in launching Operation Umbrella, and in failing to observe the most basic principles of legality and the most basic principles of the Refugees Act. Just one example, Chairperson, a young woman from Zimbabwe who had been atrociously treated in Zimbabwe. She had been repeatedly raped, and she had fled to South Africa to join her partner, her life partner, married in terms of customary law in Zimbabwe. During Operation Umbrella, the officials came to her home. She doesn't speak English, and her husband was not there. They didn't even ask her whether she was married. They didn't even ask her why she was there. They simply asked her whether she had a permit or not. She was illegal here. She spent nearly 2 weeks in Polesmoor, if not more, and she only got out by an urgent application to court. It is this kind of behavior that is bedeviling the entire system, and this bill will not remedy that. Before I get on to the actual comments on the bill, Chairperson, an issue arising about the rights of refugees and the applications and the processing of the applications themselves. Refugee status determination officers are largely, in my experience, not well trained. There's a failure to abide by the excellent UNHCR guidelines for status determination. People do not get asked the right questions. As someone earlier today mentioned in relation to Zimbabweans, the natural assumption, or the everyday assumption, is that a Zimbabwean is an economic migrant. It applies to other countries as well. People are vulnerable. They are confused. They are frightened. They are apprehensive. They are not assisted by independent interpreters. And what happens is a person is confronted by someone who doesn't place the context of what is going on before them. They get asked, why are you here?
what we often see in rejections of applications for asylum is, I came here for a better life. Now, the RSDO then puts a full stop there and says, right, you came here for economic reasons. No details as to what the person means by a better life or why it was necessary to seek a better life are elicited from the asylum seeker. Regular occurrence. Mr. Chairman, so as not to start the comments on the bill on a negative footing, in Cape Town, the backlog project has been an enormous success. It has been an outstanding success. We heard yesterday from Mr. Discover Sunday, I think, that it has been a success nationwide. There is no reason why these challenges can't be surmounted, but it needs a change of attitude on the part of Home Affairs, and a good place to start would be to follow what these contract directors of the backlog project have achieved and the way they operate. As far as the amendments to the bill themselves are concerned, Chairperson, we abide by the submissions made yesterday on behalf of the Law Society of South Africa. These are additional ones by the Legal Resources Centre, which are endorsed in turn by ALP and the TAC. Obviously, the extension of the definition of spouse is to be welcomed. The removal of the very slippery concept of
marriage. Can I find out? Based on your presentation yesterday, there's no duplication here of the recommendations. Okay, thanks.
The concept of manifestly unfounded to be replaced purely by unfounded application is welcomed. Again, we're concerned, as was the UNHCR, about the omission in Section 1, capital A, of any other relevant conventional international agreement. There seems to be no good reason for that to have been omitted. Similarly, 1A little e, we do not understand why the Immigration Act is included there and no other piece of domestic legislation, and it would be better to omit that. Then, as far as Section 3's amendment is concerned, it's obviously an excellent amendment as it stands, Chairperson, but we would suggest that another category be inserted. And that category would be adherence to local custom or refusal, above all, refusal to adhere to local custom. As the UNHCR pointed out today, there are elements in the definition which can cover other elements, and one doesn't want duplication in the Act itself. But and for instance, the one example I'm going to give, which isn't in any way exhaustive, it could conceivably be covered by gender, but for instance, female genital mutilation, that is a local custom in many places. It is clearly grounds for claiming asylum in another country. No one who came here, one would hope, fleeing female genital mutilation would be refused asylum, as the Act stands even, but there can be any number of reasons why a person who adheres to a local custom or refuses to adhere to a local custom would need asylum in another country, and perhaps that should be included as a further category. Chairperson, the amendment of Section 4.1 is really undesirable. It adds a whole new subjective quality to what should be an objective determination, and it makes things very difficult for any person wanting to take an administrative decision maker's decision under review. The wording in the old Act was far more desirable, far better. Non-political crimes are not properly defined. Again, yesterday that issue was raised, so I won't deal with it in any detail. Similarly, Chairperson, the proposed amendments to Chapter 2 of the Act are need to be reconsidered. As I mentioned yesterday, without going into detail, the Ruyobeza case actually enforced the
independence of the Standing Committee. The original Standing Committee did not comply with the Act. It was not independent. It was struck down by the High Court. It took a long time for the new Standing Committee to be properly reconstituted and put in. And it is of concern that, as Bishop Berain said earlier today, it is of concern that the powers of the Director General become increased at the expense of independent entities. Small concerns, Chairperson, Section 8, capital EF, what really is meant by a political office bearer. There's a problem with reference in Section 8G. Section 21, capital A, I think the ALP is going to deal with at a later stage. Section 21B, it's not clear whether, for example, polygamous or polyandrous marriages would be recognized. This was one of the problems which arose in the case of the National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian against the Department of Home Affairs many years ago, and would seem to need to be addressed once again. The insertion, Chairperson, of 21 capital B2, as I said yesterday, is an unenforceable and unreasonable requirement, and should be deleted. 21 B4, the two-year provision, Chairperson, in addition to the objections raised by the UNHCR, the two-year provision is just arbitrary and unfair. It doesn't make sense. It should be deleted. I've already said that the amendment of Section 22.1 and the replacement of the Standing Committee by the Director General and his or her delegates is an undesirable development. Yesterday, Chairperson, I dealt at length with the issue of biometric testing. All I'm going to say about it today is that it will just make the ability of the department, which as we've seen has been marginally improved in Johannesburg to roughly a 2 month delay, infinitely more complex and infinitely more time consuming, and will absolutely negate the limited progress that has been made in this regard. I submit that this really should be revisited and rejected as a requirement. Chairperson, the provisions of Section 24.2A are excellent, but unless better training is provided for refugee status determination officers and properly trained independent interpreters, they will not be meaningful. Then there's a bit of confusion as far as Section 24.4B is concerned. Section 26 is repealed in terms of Clause 17 of the Amendment Bill. So that needs to be tidied up. 24.4.6 is problematic in that it automatically deems an application to be abandoned if it's not renewed within 90 days. It's submitted that at the very least they should read an application may be deemed to be abandoned if the asylum seeker has not attempted to renew his or her asylum seeker permit. Chairperson, again, this is a problem which has been encountered by, well, they don't regard it as a problem, but it's a problem insofar as the immigration officials are concerned. The attitude of the immigration officials is that if you fail to renew your permit, you are therefore illegal and you should therefore be deported. And they fail to take into account the notion of non-refoulement, that however naughty you are as an asylum seeker, you cannot be sent back to your own country if you face persecution, danger or death there. So it's an issue that needs to be dealt with in a more comprehensive and understanding way. possibly it should simply be left as an offence. I've got no problem with someone who has failed to renew his or her asylum seeker permit being charged and punished.
Sentenced to Polesmoor.
Yes, but not sent from Polesmoor to Somalia. People can pay fines, people can get suspended sentences, people can be imprisoned if necessary. But the way things are done at the moment is that you are in danger, and it's a very real danger. We've had to go to court for several people who would have been sent back to Kenya, who would have been sent back to Somalia, who would have been sent back to the Democratic Republic of Congo, purely because they had failed to renew their permits or they had failed to acquire permits because of the endless queues down at Customs House, with which you, Chairperson, are sadly very familiar.
Okay.
And understand the problems extremely well. So that needs to be looked at. As far as the repeal of Section 25 is concerned, it flows obviously from the demise of the Standing Committee. It is unacceptable. Something must be done to replace that. And as Mr. Moultrie pointed out, it is not acceptable for a system that has been criticized for its inefficiency, as was done in the Tafira case, simply to be jettisoned. It indicates a desire to sweep a problem under the carpet rather than to deal with it constructively. Section 27B, it was exhaustively dealt with yesterday, Chairperson. It remains a problem. 27C, again, there's a problem with independence, and it's not really understood why 27G, as it stands, has to be jettisoned. And it's feared that this will amount to a curtailment of the rights presently set out in 27G, which would be unlawful. It would both offend against the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the international law instruments. And we've heard from the UNHCR at length about that today, and we associate ourselves with those criticisms. There's perhaps unnecessary verbiage caused by the insertion of 27A, but again, on the basis of them doing no harm, we don't have a major objection to them. As far as the amendment to Section 29.1 is concerned, I really submit, for the reasons set out yesterday, that a review of detention should be undertaken by the High Court. We've heard today from Bishop Paul Varane about the extraordinary conduct of the magistrate. That wasn't just an anecdote. This does tend to happen in lower courts, and it would be desirable, given the importance of the issues, that the matter be reviewed by a high court rather than a magistrate court.
Only because of that small incident?
I beg your pardon?
Because of that particular incident?
That's the point, Chairperson. That was not an isolated incident.
Okay.
There have been other problems involving magistrates and asylum seekers and refugees where their rights have not been respected. Magistrates are excellent officials and excellent dispensers of judges of justice, but the dangers of that kind of incident taking place in a high court are far less. And for those reasons, I would submit that it would be better if the high court were to be the arbiter
rather than we insist on training of magistrates at that level? Because part of what you have said earlier was that they themselves don't understand these laws. Why can't we want to insist on that rather than taking people to a very expensive process which will take years before your matter is heard in the High Court?
That may be a problem. Certainly, perhaps the issues should be taken in parallel. Perhaps the later amendment, pending the education of magistrates, can be introduced to return it to the magistrate court.
Okay, thanks. Carry on.
Thank you.
You're doing very well. You always comes in. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Then, as far as section... Section 27, clause 27 of the bill. Chairperson, is there are obligations imposed on asylum seekers and refugees, but there's no obligation expressed on the part of the officials of the Department of Home Affairs to notify the refugees of their obligations. And it would be unfair to impose a sanction on an asylum seeker or refugee for failure to comply with the laws of a strange country without spelling out the requirement that those obligations be observed by the asylum seeker or refugee. And the same applies to Section 34, capital A. Then, Chairperson, general comment at the end, particularly with reference to the explanatory memorandum, it's submitted that the changes in the bill are not merely definitional. They are substantive, and two of the concerns are the decrease in judicial oversight and the increase in control by the Director General. Both of which are undesirable. The department has not distinguished itself as far as asylum seekers and refugees are concerned, and we submit it as important that they retain that an element of independent monitoring can be retained. Further, as far as the explanatory memorandum is concerned, for an act to be amended so as to bring it into line with departmental and governmental policies rather than the other way around does not seem to be appropriate, particularly in the light of the experience of what has been universally described as a dysfunctional department. It's incorrect to suggest that there are no constitutional implications contained in the amendment to the Act, and here we're particularly concerned around healthcare and access to social services, which will be addressed by the ALP. And then a final disquieting paragraph, Chairperson. That the FIRA case, for example, has found that the asylum and refugee system is already unmanageably overburdened, and simply to replace non-functioning institutions with new ones is no guarantee that the structural problems will disappear. And again, I think yesterday, Mr. Scrivasunday was talking about the replacement of refugee reception officials by RSDOs, but the function still remains. There has to be someone carrying out that function. You'll have to, provision has to be made for that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. I'm sorry to put you under pressure, but I know as a lawyer you can handle any situation. thank you very much. Can I give Hossi, can you, and then followed by Law, very, very brief. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Very brief. Mine is not in fact a question, it's just a comment. I'm a little bit puzzled by my learned friend here, being a lawyer really. What is that? It's confusion. I mean, you cannot complain of unending queues and long process. At the same time, you opt for an expensive and time-consuming mechanism. Because really, if you say this should be determined by High Court, they would give you something like a 6 months period before they can hear that case. So that is time consuming, but at the same time you're saying these processes are too long.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing which also takes me aback is the questions of the magistrates are not well trained to me, magistrates and judges have received the same training. It's not a question of experience. But also some of the magistrates are more experienced than judges. We found that someone has been a magistrate for more than 30 years. And a young lawyer became a magistrate, applied to be a judge, and then he was commended. Within a 10-year period, he's a judge of the High Court. Is that man more experienced than that magistrate who's been on the bench for more than 30 years? So I don't find the rationale behind his reason, really.
Okay.
I just wanted to make that comment here.
All right. Now, thanks, Roger. It has been clarified too that there's a need to emphasize that the
local magistrate plays a role. But thank you very much, Kosi. Lo, can you come in?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will also be very brief. Mr. Kerfer, thank you very much indeed for your input. I found it constructive, I found it concise, I found it succinct. I was particularly informed by your comments around what we've appear to be simply replacing one set of unenforceable rules with something else that's not enforceable. Perhaps at some stage, Chairperson, we need to address that as a committee because it's a theme that's coming through regularly, and I do share that concern. Also the fact, Chair, that we don't want to replace a set of police and officialdom that we've had in the past in the future. And I think those are two things we need to bear in mind. Chair, if I could just very quickly ask Mr. Kerfoot to address himself to the proposed amendment to Section 22.4. It's a requirement for biometric testing. And in your presentation, you make a very good case for doing away with it. You make some very good points about the fact that, particularly on safekeeping and other areas. But I would simply ask you, what is the alternative? And again, with asking that question, I make the point for in an ideal situation, we have a country where Home Affairs has records, whether they're fingerprints or whatever, of every citizen, of everybody who's born, of everybody who dies, of everybody who comes into the country. Now, that's ideally where we want to get to. And I would read into this proposed amendment, we're starting to do that. And I'm told that biometric testing is the way that we go, away from fingerprints. So I hear your concerns. I'm not necessarily opposed to them, but I would just say, what is the alternative in the circumstances? Thanks, Chair.
So what? The last one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also support what my colleague Hojima Teve already alluded with regard to the recommendation of the High Court, Chairperson. The High Court is not user-friendly from the pure people who are staying without something to eat. The High Court is user-friendly for the rich people, Chairperson. I would rather request the presenter to suggest a traditional court rather than a High Court, Chairperson.
Traditional court. Yeah. Yeah. This is the issue of traditionally that comes back again. And we always undermine that level.
Yeah.
So you're proposing that this case can be referred to the traditional court.
Without paying a cent.
We need an advice then. Do you want to respond?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Mm.
There's no contradiction with regard to the first question. The delays, not that many people are in detention. Applications for detention can be done timelessly before the High Court. It is not as though that will provide further delays, and they're completely distinguishable from the delays caused at ground level with people not being given a document to enable them to be legally in the country for periods for up to over a year, and certainly several months. Although perhaps the solution then, as the chairperson has recommended, be that there be intensive training of magistrates in regard to the Act, that may well be a solution. One does have problems with high court accessibility at times, but that is a point to be looked at. With the magistrate court. Then as far as the question of biometric testing is concerned, Chairperson,
As things stand, citizens only have to provide fingerprints and obviously photographs as is required for asylum seekers and refugees. If an acceptable system is reached for all persons in the country to have some form of biometric identification, and that it's applied equally and not in this discriminatory sense against asylum seekers or refugees, I would not have a problem with that, provided it is constitutional, provided it is accepted, provided all the requisite safeguards are in place. But to introduce it at this stage for asylum seekers and refugees, quite apart from the discrimination aspect and the human rights aspect, from a practical point of view, I just think it's a disaster, and I would urge the committee to scrap that provision, certainly at this stage. I think that dealt with the third question in respect to the first one. Okay. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right. Now, thank you very much. Today, with your legal resource cap, you're more active when you're wearing this one. So I'm not sure that
who pays more.
Who pays more? It seems that our society is a voluntary organization. No. Thank you very much. Same applies. I don't want to cut you short, but the issues you raise are almost similar, but here you sort of deal with specific areas. Therefore, the committee will then sit and look at these proposals as you put them. And I think yesterday in our engagement, we sort of agree that the issue of the biometrics is something that we'll have to look at quite very seriously. Because that thing is coming, not only for refugees, or asylum seekers, but even for citizens. So therefore, without proper engagement with the citizens around this issue, it may create problems, because you deal more details with the, DNA of people to be kept, whatever. So I think I just want to warn for now the department, as much as they are piloting the smart card, you must take into account the serious issues that they will have to deal with, so that the public can be given an opportunity to know the safekeeping and what information that will be keeping in whatever levels of data that we want from the members as individuals and all of that. Members, I was just checking with the AIDS Law Project, and they've made quite a very thick a document, and I don't want to cut them and say to them they must summarize. It will not be correct if we can do that, because we've given almost everybody an opportunity to present, and we do not complain much about the time, even if we extend it. My proposal will be that at some point I want the committee, maybe together with everybody here, we sort of reflect a little bit on this issue of xenophobia, and then from there break for lunch and come back for lunch, and I hope that everybody will come back, because the AIDS Project have listened to everybody who was here. It will be nice to have you back again, all of us, to listen to their presentation. It's quite a very detailed presentation of yours, and it will be good, in fact, that we give them that opportunity and we listen to them. So that's my proposal. But I don't know, on this issue that I'm raising, maybe you'll help me, and then members of the committee, the current developments with regard to the attack on foreigners, I thought it's something that we should reflect on, because we touched it yesterday, and then even today the speakers who were making presentation were raising this matter quite very serious. And I said earlier that it has been, and it will remain be, the work of this committee to make sure that, the asylum seekers and refugees who are in this country are treated, fairly, with respect and dignity. But therefore, even the law, if you look at the immigration law, calls for the Department of Home Affairs to counter these xenophobic attacks and tendencies. And at some point, we know that there's a directorate
at the Department of Home Affairs that is responsible for counter-xenophobia, but that may not be the only department that is having to deal with these challenges. I will say that it's a responsibility of the state and ourselves as citizens, South Africans in general, to deal with this issue. But I wanted to give opportunity to members maybe to reflect a little bit on this matter. And then because part of what we looked at yesterday was that either there will be a need for us to complement the work that we saw yesterday. The Minister of Home Affairs was in the forefront yesterday, meeting with families, friends, and the community in that area. Therefore comes in the role of the Portfolio Committee again, that in a situation like this one, we represent members of the public by their votes for us to be here. Therefore, we have that particular mandate again to deal with challenges of this nature when we are confronted with. Therefore, I want to give a committee a brief reflection on this matter and sort of agree as to what will be the intervention part of the committee, which will try, and assist, and not only leaving the committee, but all of us who are in this meeting, we have a responsibility, I think, to make sure that there's huge public education around the issues and the rights of asylum seekers and refugees in the country. I mean, the numbers, as we have listened today, is that we have over 40,000 refugees that we have in the country. But we have over 3 to 4 million either asylum seekers or illegal immigrants or whatever that we have in the country. And I think these are things that we need to reflect on, honestly so, and then as a committee to agree as to if we are to call the department again at some point to hear from them what is it that they're doing, because there's a directorate responsible for issues of anti-xenophobic campaign. So we will have to reflect on these issues, members. And maybe members will want to say something before we sort of agree, because maybe at the end of the day we should issue a statement as a committee, condemning, something that we must condemn in the strongest term, in fact. But let me give members who always... Lo, can I start with you? I saw you raise your hand already.
I didn't raise my hand, Chairperson.
But I know that you are very good at raising.
If you'd like me to say something, Chairperson, I'd be very happy to. I think I would certainly agree with you. I think it behoves this committee to make a public statement of what has been happening. And we may well have a very robust discussion this afternoon as to what exactly we should say in that statement. But I certainly think we could do something. If there's time, have a brief discussion and possibly issue a statement. And not that it's going to change what's happening out there, but I would agree with you. I think we need to have perhaps a public campaign. We need to be saying something. We need to direct the Department of Home Affairs. Perhaps we can work with the minister. I think we'd all have our own views as to what exactly needs to happen. I would certainly have some very strong views, but I think perhaps in the context of the committee we could talk about it, but I would absolutely support you. Yeah. Thank you.
Is there any other thing, Jose? And I think we are sort of agreeing that we'll have to have this discussion maybe after this meeting, and the issue of the statement, it will be correct to talk to our people, not only them but those that were in the country, because it really gives the country a very a bad picture. Sometimes when you attend some of these international, events outside South Africa, always you are viewed as this country that is not tolerant to, outsiders, refugees and all of that. Therefore, I think it's important that we need to bring out that message. The committee has done its part, as I've said. I mean, it's only this parliament that we invited over 700 people some time ago, but the follow-up again, after that engagement, is one thing that we need to look at. We need not only to engage around the issues here at this level. Part of what we have done for the workshop that is taking place next week, we have invited the city of Johannesburg, Bishop, if the Bishop is still here. We have invited the city of Johannesburg because they have a plan around the issue of integration of refugees and asylum seekers. So they will be making a presentation in the workshop that's going to take place next week. So this will be like a kind of an assistant to members of the committee to understand some of these things deeper at local level, because integration must take place at that local level, and that's the level that we are not very much in touch with, your councillors, your traditional leaders and all of that. I think that's what we must then focus on. So on that note, what the committee will do then, will then come together, look at it, and then issue a statement. But there's a need for us to be seen going down to where people are. The sister there earlier, she said that in Mpumalanga, the questionnaire that you only come here when you are dealing with issues of refugees. We have not seen you before, but I believe that this committee has been in touch with a number of communities, and we need to maintain that going down there. If need be, in our discussion, I have already asked AD to look at Parliament support, because again, it depends on Parliament support and approval. There will be a need for us to be seen down there, not only there in the Western Cape and anywhere where the issue of xenophobic raises its head again. This committee must be very vocal and very critical on those issues. So on that note, can I propose that we break, Honourable Law and members. We go to lunch, same journey again. I'm told it's 90 Plain Street. Lunch is being arranged for everybody. Lunch is being arranged for everybody. So let's go and have lunch, and then we'll convene at 2:45. We'll convene here again. Thank you very much.